My guy. Okay, we're going to get started. We're a few minutes over, so we're going to get going.
Jen finally decided that I'm going to move in. She says it will help me get more organized, and I says nothing.
You know how to work that?
No.
A lot of emails.
Okay, thank you for coming. If you're new to the RAC procedure, please make sure that if you have a comment on an agenda item, there are some comment cards in back, and you would fill those out regarding the agenda item that you want to speak to and bring them up to either Chris or Morgan. And so thank you for coming. We will begin tonight by doing an approval of the agenda and the minutes from last meeting. So, do I have a motion on that? Oh, thank you. Or questions or comments?
Make a motion, we approve the agenda and the minutes.
Okay, we have a motion by Eric Luke to approve the agenda and the meeting, or the minutes. Do I have a second on that?
I'll second it.
And a second by Kurt. And all in favor? Looks unanimous, and it's passed. So next we have an update, and that is by me. So I'm going to try to concentrate just on the items that we were somewhat concerned about. So this is from the last meeting. We were somewhat concerned about the numbers on the Central Mountains Manti, and those numbers were reduced by 200, and so that passed. We also were concerned about keeping the Pine Valley unit at the 2017 numbers, and that passed unanimously. One of our big concerns, and I went to the meeting with quite a bit of information and tried to really put that to task, was the division recommended an increase on the limited entry book cliffs tags, mule deer tags, from increasing them by 35. They did go up by 15 in the end, and that passed. So Kevin came in and kind of proposed a motion to reduce the division's recommendation, and it did come down by quite a bit. Trying to think about anything else that was of interest to us, and let me know if this... Okay, yeah. We retained the elk permits on the Manti at 2017 numbers. And then the other was the sheep permits. There was the move to decrease them from 3 to 2, and that passed unanimously. And I think that was the major concerns. Are there any questions on that? So we pretty much got what we wanted, except for the book cliff tags, and I think we made a compromise there. Right. So at this point, we'll have the regional update. I was giving Chris a hard time. He's a little scruffy.
Yeah. good evening. Trish also commented on the lighting. It's kind of weird. She wanted a cocktail with the lighting like this. But the back lights don't work, and a lot of these bulbs are out, so we put on these weird lights. So hopefully it's... calming, or I don't know.
It would be more calming with a cocktail.
Just give you an update on what we're doing as an agency the last few months and the next couple of weeks. These are some great pictures, by the way, that Morgan took. So if nothing else, you'll be looking at some great new pictures, too. They're not just stock photos that we sometimes use. These are great new photos. So our aquatic section has a big project going on starting next week. Well, it's been going on for a year or two now, but in Range Creek, we've treated that creek with rotenone, and we're stocking native cutthroat trout. So we'll be on two different properties in the next 2 weeks, working with the Preston Nutter Ranch and also Butch and Jeannie Jensen, and stocking these cutthroats on their stretches of creek, on those lands, and also there'll be some public land too that these native cutthroat trouts get stocked. So that's a really exciting kind of high profile project that we're working on with these private landowners and with the BLM too. We also have something called Conservation Days happening with the U.S. Forest Service in the upcoming weeks. It's a day where the middle schoolers in Emory County go up to Huntington Canyon and learn about wildlife biology and the creek ecology and do some fun interactive hands-on experience with our biologists. So Morgan will be involved with that as well. And then it's that time of year. We do this twice a year. It's our gillnet surveys. Tomorrow, I believe, is the 10th, right? Tomorrow we'll be at Schofield, and then next week we'll be at Joes Valley. And if anyone would like to attend either one of those, you're more than welcome to come. So we put out gill nets the day before. On the 10th and the 16th, we'll pull those gill nets, and we'll get. It's kind of a snapshot of what's happening in the reservoir. So species composition, size of fish, and from that we can see whether our management strategies are working or not. As you remember, the Schofield has a new management plan. We've invited the managers of that Schofield management plan, those who were on the management team, I should say, to that event. So that'll be kind of fun, too, for them to see whether, and the answer is it is, but whether the management plan's working or not. Our habitat folks have been busy. Restoration used to be kind of more of a fall activity, but anymore it happens year-round. I believe this is a planting project that happened at our Huntington game farm last month. We planted a whole bunch of shrubs and cottonwoods and willows and for upland game and for other species that are there. Also in our habitat section, we have a new habitat manager, Makita. You'll hear from her today. So congratulations, Makita. She's worked for us for, I think, 7 or 8 years, but she's fantastic, and she'll do a great job leading the habitat team. Daniel Eddington was the habitat manager before, but he's been on a crew mobility for over a year now, so he still works for us. He's just in the Salt Lake office overseeing the watershed restoration initiative funding end of things. So we're that time of year we hire a whole bunch of seasonals in all of our sections, but the habitat seasonals work on our division lands. They spray weeds, they fix guzzlers, they help out on lots of different things. So we have a planting at Nash Wash, which is our wildlife management area in the South Book Cliffs coming up. And then currently, I just was up there today, actually, there's some brush treatments on the north end of the LaSalle's with the Forest Service, cleaning up some like oak brush and other understory. It looks really good, actually. And law enforcement, they're busy too. Our AIS program, our Aquatic Invasive Species program, is in full swing. We have a checkpoint coming up, and so boaters coming out of Lake Powell will be stopped, and we'll make sure that they understand and are complying with the regulations of drying or draining their boats and understanding where they're going next and how long they have to dry or whether they have to decontaminate or not. They have several cases going through the courts. And then our Cops and Bobbers event, it's our big community event in Carbon County where we invite families to come to the fairgrounds and participate in an archery shoot and in the community pond, a fishing event. We supply all the things you need to have a nice fishing experience. That'll happen on June 9th. Our outreach section has also been really busy, and they have a few more events coming up in the next 10 days. Coming up this Saturday, we're teaming up with the Nature Conservancy, and we're having hosting a migratory bird day on the Matheson Wetland Preserve in Moab. Beginning at 8 o'clock, we'll have guided bird tours, and then at 9 o'clock, we'll have different stations people can walk around and do some birding. So that should be a great event. And then on the 19th, here in Green River, we have a ladies' trap shoot clinic. I think we're capping the attendance at some point, so if you're interested in that, let's talk. We'll get you RSVP'd for the event. So it's been a great turnout in the past. We've gotten a lot of good reviews from people who attend that event and really all of our events. So we're always trying to improve and offer opportunities and to different people with different interests, and we hold events every month or so on different things. And then our wildlife section, they've been teaming up with our habitat folks. That picture there is kind of what I've been doing the last 2 days, teaming up with our wildlife guys and our habitat folks and the agency personnel from Forest Service and BLM, and visiting our winter ranges and assessing what the brush conditions look like, what kind of browsing pressures we received over the summer, look at utilization, and talk about the range conditions. It's a good time to get out and see what's happened over the winter. We're also working on pronghorn unit plans coming up. Our sensitive species biologist, Scott, will be doing some bird surveys and some white nose syndrome bat surveys. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, next we'll have Justin Shannon giving us a wildlife project update. So, do you want to tell us what you did? Like, what did you do to yourself?
What do you mean?
He said he's sore from running.
Oh. Exercising the demons of my life and it hurts.
Well, you're supposed to, like, ease into it.
So, Trish is a running coach.
I think I need a life coach, not Now I have this coworker named Covey Jones, and he thought it'd be a good idea to sign me up for Ragnar. And I'm not a runner, so this is going to be painful.
It's horrible. I've done them. They're horrible.
I only run from mean cows anyway.
What was that? I said I only run from mean cows. I don't have
to. Fair enough.
Built for comfort, not speed. Enough. I ain't gonna lie.
Okay. Well, what an awkward introduction. My name's Justin Shannon. I'm the wildlife section chief, and today I'm going to give a presentation that just kind of highlights our wildlife and habitat projects that we've done throughout the state. I'm going to give a 30,000-foot overview, some big-picture stuff, and then at the end of my presentation, we're going to give the region a chance to talk about some specific wildlife and habitat projects that have been done here. So to begin, the purpose of this informational PowerPoint is twofold. The first is the Wildlife Board asked us to share an overview of how conservation and expo permit funds have benefited wildlife and habitat. And we've done pretty good job in both of those areas. We've done some good things for wildlife, done some good things for habitat, but my second point there is we don't do a good job of highlighting these successes. We're really poor cheerleaders when it comes to the good things that we've done. And as an agency, we have areas that we can improve, there's no doubt, but there's certainly some good things that we've done, and we wanted to highlight that tonight and kind of what our agency's been engaged in and how the conservation and expo permit funds have helped with that. So to begin, looking at big game captures and transplants, over the last 5 years, we've captured 74 bison, 124 mountain goats, and 312 pronghorn throughout the state. Those pronghorn mostly on the Parker Mountain, and that's helped us to control that population and to start new ones and augment existing populations that we have. And also, we've left some radio collars on that unit to better understand that population, how things are going as far as increases or decreases. So we've done some good things there. With bighorn sheep, we've captured almost 800 animals, translocated over half of them. The other ones we've left radio collars on, GPS collars, to get movement data, and then also disease samples so we can figure out the disease profile of every bighorn herd in the state. And we've got just about all those. Learning a lot about our moose in Utah, we've captured 174 over the last 5 years. Mostly on the Wasatch and the North Slope, and learned a lot about the limiting factors of moose in Utah. For elk, that picture on the bottom left, we've captured 817 and translocated 128, mostly to the Oker-Stansbury unit. That machine, I'm not sure who here has ever been on an elk capture or deer capture with us. If you haven't been, we invite you to come. They're pretty neat. That machine is interesting. You can put it on these animals. It's an ultrasound machine. So we can measure body fat. We can measure muscle mass. And from there, when we're done, we can say this deer is 11% body fat or this elk is 9% body fat. And that helps us in our management decisions as to whether we're going to feed elk or feed deer in northern Utah during hard winters and some of the other management issues we face. And then in the bottom right, we've captured almost 4,000 deer, translocated over 1,300. A lot of that's our urban translocation efforts on the Wasatch Front. But we've learned more about our deer in the last 5 years than I mean, and it's been really good. When sportsmen are saying, we're seeing this, we can come and say, well, here's what our radio caller's saying, and we have some common ground, and we can be talking about the same issues. It's great. For big game research, I won't go into all these, but we've done a lot of projects over the last 5 years. Looked at Wasatch elk, for example, that one in the far left. We've completely changed how we manage elk because of the data that we obtained on that research through BYU. What we found is during the hunts, the elk will congregate on private lands, and when the hunts are over, they go back to public lands, and that's frustrating to public hunters, and it's hard for landowners because they're saying, I've got this influx of animals on me. And so we've came out with private lands only permits to help alleviate that and distribute elk and give some landowners relief. Monroe Fawn Survival looked at survival rates from 0 to 6 months. That was a great project, and even the top one, effects of habitat treatments on mule deer. We've been doing a lot of habitat restoration, which I'll show in a bit, and we want to look at, are deer using these? If they do they survive better than deer that don't? Are they in better body condition? Do they have more offspring? Those types of things. So pretty good research. This is pretty neat. Just wanted to show a quick video, if I can do it. And this is on the Wasatch unit when we're capturing elk, and I just wanted to show everybody how it looks through the capture company's eyes. That's a net gun, and that's what we use for our big game captures. And it just ties them up. They get really wrapped up in that. And then this person jumping out is called a mugger, and they'll secure the animal, put a radio collar on it, oftentimes sling it back to us or draw blood. But that was just a cool GoPro video that we thought would be kind of fun. So with big game, this is a lot of what we've been doing. Moving to upland game and waterfowl, we've translocated 5,300 geese. A lot of this is on golf courses and urban areas to help with public tolerance there. We've translocated close to 5,000 turkeys and even quail. Well, that's a horrible picture, but we've moved Gamble's quail, California quail, scaled quail all throughout the state. It's been kind of neat. Pheasant releases and chucker releases. We've released 50,000 pheasants and 10,000 chuckers. A lot of this is for hunter opportunity, and groups like Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife have been really integral in this and in helping us do that. And then some sage-grouse translocations as well. If you look at the monitoring and research, we've done a lot, from basic ecology on the dusky grouse study in the bottom right to sage grouse. The last 15 years or so, it's just been really heavy on sage grouse research, on nesting habitat, brood rearing, survival, habitat use. It's been really good. Even ptarmigan research. We have ptarmigan in Utah in the High Uintas. Done some research there. It's just been great. Mammals research. Done a lot of cougar studies in the state. The most recent one was Okra Stansberry's with Dustin Mitchell, and then bear studies and bear monitoring. Every year we look at bear reproduction, and that helps us know when we can anticipate pulses in the population and gear up our resources for conflicts when those yearling bears separate from their moms and tackle life on their own and get in trouble sometimes. So. The Utah Migration Initiative, this is pretty neat. This is a something that we've started. I'm not sure if anyone's heard of this yet, but we started this about a year ago, and the purpose of this is to identify, preserve, and enhance movement pathways and corridors for species through strong partnerships, compelling outreach, and the use of advanced tracking and data management technology. essentially, if you look at Utah, our population is going to double in the next 30 years. So we're going to grow, and how do we grow responsibly? If we have some foresight and we have a bunch of information on pathways that deer and elk and pronghorn and a variety of species are using, then as we grow, we can say, these corridors are really, really important. You know, these areas are highly valued by wildlife. If we're going to develop, let's make sure we develop responsibly. Got a quick video of the Utah Migration Initiative. This is some capture work we did on the Ponsagat unit this last year, where we radio colored a bunch of does and looked at migration routes, but we also radio captured some bucks, and I thought I'd show this real quick. This has been a lot of fun, this Utah Migration Initiative. This was funded primarily through conservation and expo dollars, and it has been really neat to see how wildlife are using the landscape. We've documented some deer traveling upwards to 107 miles in some cases, one of which was born on the south slope of the Uintas, and it ended up living near Hiawatha, if you can believe that. These deer down here on the Ponsagat, we've documented movements up to 70, 80 miles where they'll go past the Ponsagat up onto the Panguitch Lake unit, and then they'll winter in Arizona. So it's just interesting to understand how wildlife are using the landscape, and I think it's going to help us manage better, especially with our unit-by-unit hunting and understanding these populations better. Moving on to habitat. Utah is a watershed and habitat restoration partnership that is unmatched. We currently have more than 100 partners that have participated in the Watershed Restoration Initiative, or WRI, since 2006. And the priorities of WRI are to increase watershed health and biological diversity, improve water quality and yield, and provide opportunities for sustainable uses of the natural resources. This is big picture stuff. We want to make sure our landscapes are healthy for wildlife and livestock and the ecology as well. You look at what's been accomplished. In the far right, we have a completed circle there, and we've completed 1,751 projects and almost 1.5 million acres. And we've spent $186 million and got another $20 million of in-kind funding, so over $200 million. Currently, we're working on 281 projects, just over a quarter million acres, at the tune of about $61 million. And what we have lined up is another close to 200 projects, just over a quarter million acres, or nearly a quarter million acres, and about $45 million in funding. So when it's all said and done, we'll have treated about 2 million acres and spent about $300 million on habitat restoration, which is just incredible. That's more than Western states combined over the last 12 years on what we've been doing. It's really impressive. So there's two kind of projects that we work with WRI. One is proactive restoration, which is essentially where we try to take pinyon juniper stands and other habitats and treat those to get more grasses and forbs and shrubs on the landscape. And then there's fire rehabilitation. You know, we've had fires like the Sealy Fire and Bryan Head and Milford Flat, and that's highlighted in red there. And as we've treated that, that's been really important. And I'll show why here in a second. How are we funded? Most of this is through federal funding. We've got great partnerships with the BLM, the Forest Service. Our federal partners have been really good to work with. And it makes sense. A lot of our projects occur on federal land. That's where a lot of this work is happening. The second biggest contributor is the state, and a lot of this comes from hunting and fishing license dollars. As you buy permits and those types of things, a portion of that goes towards habitat restoration. And then our third biggest contributor is the sportsman groups. And this is where the conservation and expo permits come into play. Excuse me. And one thing that I want to point out is oftentimes with the federal dollars, they require a match. So they'll match it several dollars to $1, but they need that initial seed money to do it. And that's where the state dollars, the sportsman groups dollars, and then the rest of our partners, counties, private landowners are really, really critical to what we're doing. Municipalities, mitigation money, those types of things help serve as that match. And it you know, this is $300 million, and this is kind of what the pie looks like. Restoration priorities. I'll go through these briefly, but I'll show some examples. But it's we treat landscapes, we treat stream restoration, we have fire rehab. It's all encompassing. This is neat. This is called a bull hog. I'll show this video. You can put this giant chopper on the end of a machine, and it just crushes through these pinyon and juniper trees. And it's really a good design because at a small scale, it can work one of these trees down to the stump, and as it does it, it sprays that chopped wood out on the landscape. And if you'll see here, there's no grasses, there's no flowers, there's no shrubs, there's nothing on the landscape right there for livestock. There's nothing on the landscape for wildlife. And so this is an area that has limited value when it comes to grazing. It's kind of neat to see how that works. And they can treat quite a few acres with that little machine there pretty inexpensively. Fire rehab. In 2002, there on the left, there was a fire called the Maple Springs Fire, and it was treated with some flame-resistant seed mixes, and which is good, and it's responded really well. And 11 years later, we had the Black Mountain Fire, and as this fire came through, because of the efforts that were done a decade earlier, it served as a stopping point for that fire. And it's great because it's left forage on the landscape for livestock and for wildlife, and it gave firefighters a place safe to work. So this is the value of doing fire restoration. Tintic Valley. This is another area where historically we had a fire every 35 to 50 years, and by the 1990s, this thing was burning every 2 to 3 times a decade. And so it was treated with some perennial grasses to help make it so it's not a weed patch like the upper left there just waiting to burn. And 15 years later, that's come in really good. And this is kind of the goal that we have with fire restoration. Chaining. Show this video if I can. This is something we do oftentimes after a fire where we get these giant chains. These are really heavy. I don't even think Eric can lift up one of these links. They're really big. And they're pulled between two of these big dozers, and it just knocks these trees down, and it disturbs the soil. So that way, as we fly seed on, the ground is ready for that seed mix to hit, and it just has a better response as a result. And these links, it's interesting, will weld railroad ties perpendicular to each link to kind of get that ground disturbed. And as these trees are run over, it'll crush them down and break it, so the ground is more prepared. A couple more slides. So Tabby Mountain, we've done some chainings where we haven't had fire. This is one we did in 2007. You'll see the picture there on the left. Not a lot of grasses or forbs. We chained it at two-way chaining, and 4 years later, that's the response. Lots of grasses, lots of vegetation. And then finally, Kingston Canyon WMA. Before this treatment, you can see those banks. In many cases, wildlife can't even access the water. That stream has a lot of silt and erosion that's occurring, which hurts the fishery there. Went in and firmed up the banks of this river, and 9 years later, this is what you get. You get willows. I mean, this is great for wildlife as a whole. I mean, our non-game species, everything benefits from this, and as a result, it's one of the better fisheries that we have down there as well. So, in summary, the division and our partners, we're trying to improve our wildlife management via monitoring and our research. The Watershed Restoration Initiative is restoring habitat at an extremely aggressive rate, and that has benefits to wildlife, livestock, all sorts of ecosystems. And then finally, funding for these projects comes from a variety of sources, including a large portion from hunters. So, and that's all I have. And so, who's up next, Makita or Guy?
I got one question, Justin, real quick.
What's that?
Just out of curiosity, how does it work relocating geese?
Geese?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's
it's pretty much, I mean, they go where they want, when they want.
We get them at a time where they're molting, and so they can't fly. And so that's how you, that picture where we were herding them, that's literally what you do. And so it's a, you should come with us. I mean, if you want to come up to the Wasatch Front and herd geese, you can make a memory. It's pretty neat. I'm not joking. It is actually pretty cool if you'd want to come. So. Yeah, but they have a period where they can't fly, and so that's when we do that. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I shouldn't have told you that. I should have said, we're really good. Like, we just tell these geese over here. And they just
I have to have somebody do this that knows how to, knows a little bit about computers and technology. What I'd like to talk about is a little more of, expand on what Justin talked about, and more specific to the region, some of the, a brief overview of the projects that we have going in this region, and also it's basically just to highlight some of the types of information that we've been able to get from these projects. It's pretty exciting stuff. There's a lot of neat information and a large volume of information that we've been able to collect in a short period of time, and it's quite an effort. One of the ones I want to talk about quite a bit is what we've done with radio telemetry. When I was a biologist, I had at one point I had about 100 radios that I thought I was really doing something, and that, boy, this is neat information, and they were all VHF. And now Dustin Mitchell, the biologist that replaced me, has over 300 collars that he monitors. And so it's become a bigger workload, but it's some great information that's helped us a lot with our information on these different species, and can apply back towards our management and helps do a better job of making recommendations and decisions regarding these species. So, and one of them is this GPS technology that we've used recently. We've put out a lot more GPS collars in the past couple of years, and we've been able to get a greater amount of information in terms of movements, survival, mortality factors, and because they're we can monitor them fairly regularly. We almost have instantaneous information about when an animal has died or mortality, so we can go out and try and determine the cause of that mortality. There is a big difference in the two types of radios that we use. It depends on our study objectives, because the cost for GPS is quite a bit greater. We can't put out quite as many as we can with VHF. We can put out a lot of VHF collars for the same amount as a lot smaller number of GPS. But it just depends on what kind of information we want to get out of those collars, whether we're looking at day-to-day movements or just whether those animals survive or not. In this region, we have radio telemetry studies on about every one of those species, on all of our big game species, with the exception of moose. We have everything from collars on bison on the Henry Mountains to a better picture of this quail that, that Justin showed. It's quite a variety of sizes. You can get carried away, I think. I don't think we're at the point we want to put cameras on deer. One of the main ones that we've been working on is our deer research project, and I don't know where where Justin got all the videos of nice weather capture work. This is more typical of, this was when we had winters actually, and what it looked like when we captured animals. Some of the things that we look at, the amount of data that we can collect when we have an animal in hand is pretty good. We look at all these different factors. We get age, weight, body conditions, which I'll talk a little more about. We can look at pregnancy rates. We also test all these animals for chronic wasting disease. We get blood and fecal samples to look at a variety of different things, diseases, parasite loads, even trace minerals, things like that, and what they're picking up. And then, of course, the radio telemetry part, which gives us a lot of information. Most of the deer studies that we're looking at in this region is primarily focused on survival, but we've also been able to obtain some really cool information on movements, migration, things like that. On our deer survival studies, this is some of the types of information we get from that. This is a statewide fawn survival graph, and the purple line is where we're at right now this year. So we're doing a little better than last year, along the same lines, on a statewide basis. The units in this region, the Wasatch Man type fawn survival, you can see there as well that we're doing a little bit better than what we've done the past 2 years, but not, well, we're pretty close to where we were the first year we started the study. This is kind of the bad news part of it. This is the San Juan this year. You can see what's happened. We've had basically all of our fawns that we collared have died this year on the San Juan unit. And there's some, one of the things I want to say about that, and it kind of leads back to when we make our recommendations, a lot of the different factors that we look at in deciding what recommendations to make or permits, is there's some real differences between some of the areas, some of the units. We use the San Juan as a representative unit for the surrounding units, both the LaSalle's and the Henry Mountains. But this past year, and everybody knows what we've gone through, there's some differences that kind of says you kind of got to use some of this information a little bit cautiously, and you got to look at all of it. We typically do on units that we're not, that we don't have radio collars on, we do spring survival to give us an idea if or spring classification to see if survival is similar to what we're seeing. So what this graph shows, the blue lines on both the LaSalle's and the Bajas on the left shows what our production was this year. That's our fall count of fawns per 100 does. The red line on the bottom is our buck doe ratios. And then on the right side is our survival. The red and blue lines is what, and they're the same on both because it was actually collected on the San Juan. So that shows the red line is our adult survival. The blue line is our fawn survival. But one of the things I want to point out is that on the Abajos, back on the left, you see that our fawn production was not that bad. We were at about 50 fawns per 100 does, which isn't a terrible level, it's pretty good. But on the LaSalle's, our production had dropped way off. And so, but then when we go back in the spring and look at that, the Abajos, we did conduct classification this year just because we wanted to see where what was happening, where we were going to end up. And that little dot on the right-hand side is where we actually ended up with our spring classification. And you'll notice on the LaSalle's, the green line on the bottom showed that even though we started with a lower number of fawns, produced a lower number of fawns, our survival was actually higher and better. Some of that may be related to habitat condition. We have a lower population, so they may not be up as high towards the carrying capacity as the Abajos. The Abajos, we feel like we're pretty close to our carrying capacity on that unit. So some of that might relate to the fact why in a year when we had pretty good fawn production, we had low survival. On the other unit, we had low production and higher survival. Hope that's, I didn't confuse anybody with that. But it's stuff that, information that goes to, there's a lot of information other than just the objectives that we put for that unit. We have to look at all the information we have. And this kind of, this, I think you've seen this slide before, it was in another presentation, but it shows where we're at in our corner of the state down there and how severe conditions really are. This is also interesting here, and this is one of the pieces of information we collect when we capture deer. It looks at percent body fat, both loin and rump body fat. And if you look at December 15 at the bottom at San Juan, December of 16, you can see we're 9.35, 9.25. In December of 2017, we were already way below what we were the previous two winters. So these deer likely went into winter in poorer shape than they had the previous two winters. And that may have something to do, most likely has something to do with the fawn survival. If the does aren't as healthy, they're not likely to produce as healthy fawns. Sorry about this. I apologize about this. This is the best I could get it on here. But basically what it shows is the x-axis on the bottom is the weight. The y-axis on the left is the probability of survival. So what that shows is that these fawns, if they're a lower weight in December when we catch them, their probability of survival is much less than a higher rate. And that's what we saw when we captured these. Most of our fawns were 50 pounds or less, and the previous years they'd been 60 pounds. And it seems like that difference is enough that it related to their survival. Lower weight fawns just didn't survive as well. And even though we didn't have much of a winter down there, we had very little snow, so it wasn't winter conditions that killed them. It was more likely the summer conditions and how those animals went into the winter. This is some other information that we've been able to get. We can, like I was talking about, we can get causes of death. And this is adult mortality. You can see that there's not very many. We're only talking about four on a couple of the units. But it shows some of the causes that we've been able to ascertain from going out within days after. And sometimes, even at that, if you don't get there right away, pretty much just picked apart, so it's difficult to tell what actually killed them, even though something may have scavenged on them. So that's why there's a kind of a big unknown there. This is our fawn causes of death. If you look at the San Juan, for example, you can see that it's pretty high coyote predation, a little bit bobcat predation. The Wasatch Manti seems to be, this year anyway, seems to be more equally divided between coyotes, malnutrition, and disease. Makita's going to talk a little bit more about this, but kind of like I said, we had some studies that are designed to actually look at habitat use and movement, and some of them are their survival, but we've been able to get information on movements from those other studies as well. This is from the Manti elk study, and part of that study on the Manti side was to see if those elk were crossing the highway going into the Wasatch unit. And this is all of the points of those GPS-collared animals up to this point, and none of them have crossed over, so they all stay on the south side of that highway. They're basically captured in Gordon Creek. They winter in Schofield, and then winter down along the highway there, but don't cross. This is kind of another example of what kind of information we get. The bottom blue arrow is the winter of 2017, and these are elk that were actually captured on the other side of the highway, on the north side of the highway. That's why they're different elk. But basically, the winter of 2017, they traveled over 50 miles between winter and summer range. And then this last winter, these are two different animals. The blue dots are 1 year, are two different years. I'm sorry. The blue dots are the second year. The red dots are the first year. The second year, this past year, they only moved just, what is that, 10 miles between summer and winter range. So, and what'll show up later is I'll show you some deer stuff. It's quite interesting, the differences between elk and deer and how they move and migrate in different types of winter. This is some information we got from the South Manti deer. We collared deer on the South Manti, Southeast Manti, 2 years ago. And this was kind of illustrates their movements. Most of they all moved off the west side to winter down into Nephi and that area over there. Next, I've got kind of a tale of three deer. And these are three deer from the San Juan unit. This is actually Elk Ridge. It says Abajos. But what the information gives us, the yellow is kind of the hot spot of where these animals spend more time and get quite a few locations in those spots. And one of the things it can do helpful is to identify areas that are critical and important to these animals so that when we start looking at habitat projects, we can say, well, this is where they like to winter, this is where they summer. And these are areas that we should be looking to focus our efforts in for habitat projects. The scale on this one, and down in the right-hand corner, is 10 miles. So this migration is a little over 10 miles. Scale on this one is 5 miles. So this is on Elk Ridge, on Deer Flat, and it has a much shorter migration between winter and summer range. And you can see the hot spots are bigger, spend more time in those areas. This is another deer that goes from basically from Monticello on the east side of the Abajos and winters out by almost to Hovenweep National Monument. Scale on that one's 20 miles, so we're looking at over 30 mile straight line distance of travel. Now, if I can get this to play, this shows the movements of each of these deer in the past year. They are does, so don't be fooled by the antlers on there. Let's see if we can get it. Oh, I gotta go back. Oh, maybe go back. Oh no. We had this working before. I swear we got the bugs out of it. It's not working. It's not going to show. It went dark again. Remember? Dang it. Oh, shoot. And basically what I want, it's a neat animation. It shows how the deer movements are and the distance that each of the different ones move. And this is last year in a winter that they basically had very little snow. And what it showed was they go to the same winter ranges, whether snow or not. And the deer that was by Monticello, when it came back, it kind of stopped along the highway. And I wanted to show that the area where it had migrated and came back was an area where we have a little issue with a tunnel and the crossing and the fence we have, because we have a second one. This one will work. This is the migration through a newer tunnel to the north in just one day.
Technology's great.
I love it. It's not going to work.
Are the strobe light?
Yeah.
It's the key.
Sorry about that. I apologize. These worked earlier. I don't know if we overloaded this computer or what. Kita?
I don't know.
Oh, dang it. All right. This is another... this is some movements of sage grouse. They were captured in Emma Park, and then they migrate 32 miles to winter on the Tavaputs Plateau. We didn't know that that's where these sage grouse were wintering at the time that they were captured, so this was pretty good information, and they travel over 32 miles between summer and winter range. Okay, I'd like to spend a little bit of time on something dear to my heart is our bear research, the information that we've got from some of our bear research. With the telemetry data, we've been able to visit the dens in the wintertime and collect quite a bit of information on reproduction. And like Justin had said earlier, it helps us with our management. We can see when we're going to have population pulses, higher numbers. And like this past year, 2018, we actually had more sows collared than that, but we were only able to locate 8 of them, and we had no cubs, and only 2 yearlings had survived from the 13 we saw in the dens the year before. So even, you know, deer, bears, everything is affected by the type of rain or weather conditions that we have. But you also notice at the end of that column in 2017 we had 56 nuisance incidents. So we had a high number of problems, and a lot of it was related to the summer that we had. We had an early freeze. We had no mass crops, no acorns, pine nuts, or anything like that. And so when fall came around, we had a lot of hungry bears. So we handled the. I joked early on that somebody had said, asked how it was going, and I said we were handling about a bear a day, and then later on I was wishing it was only a bear a day. Sometimes it was 3 and 4 bears a day. This is another thing we've been able to find. A lot of times when we had a bear, a nuisance bear, if we moved that bear, sometimes it would just disappear. And we had no idea where it went. We were using VHF collars, and depending on when we were able to get out and do a flight to try and locate them, they could travel a long ways. This is a GPS collar on a bear that was captured in August of 2017 near Moab, and it was released at Nash Wash on the Book Cliffs. It then almost immediately moved over towards Rangeley, Colorado, spent 3 weeks there, both sides of the border, and then by Thanksgiving Day had made a trek up to King's Peak on the Uintas. And then we denned that bear near Duchesne over in Tabiona this winter. So that kind of illustrates why we sometimes would lose these bears and have a hard time trying to keep track of them just because of their movements. So the GPS information has been really valuable in helping us to track these bears. The next one, and I had an animation for this one too, it probably won't play, but this bear was captured in Price early in fact a year ago today. We moved it out on the Jack Creek on the Book Cliffs, and this was kind of the fun thing about GPS, I guess, is we were watching this bear, and we saw that where it was at, and it, when it ended up over on Bruin Point, our biologist said, that bear is right where there's a cabin right now. And sure enough, the next day, the cabin owner called him and said, there's a bear on my front porch. And so we went and captured that bear, and because it really hadn't done anything, it hadn't shown any aggression, it was just kind of had wandered into the wrong spot, we thought we'd give it another try. So we moved it down onto Elk Ridge. And in the period of a month, and I'll probably have to explain it because I don't know that the animation will work, but it moved from Elk Ridge to over near Monticello, out on Peters Point north of Monticello, out to Canyonlands National Park, back to Elk Ridge, back to Monticello, or back north of Monticello. The last dot that's just north of Monticello was on July 20th. And the bear must have heard that we were having a celebration in Monticello on the 24th, because it showed up in Monticello during the 24th celebration. And so we had to capture it. But the distance traveled was I believe it was 160 miles total in a little over a month of that bear. I'll give it a try, but no guarantees. Probably go black.
Oh,
there, look at that. If you blink on the bottom. And the little one right down there. Okay. All right. Another kind of interesting thing we've learned with these radio telemetry bears, we've been able to put cameras on their dens after we visited the dens to see what they have there for cubs or yearlings or whatever. And initially it was to look at when they emerged from the den, how long they stayed at the den, things like that. But one of the interesting things we found was that sometimes if we have a female bear that was taken and didn't know that there was cubs, and we have cubs or orphaned yearlings and not sure what to do with them, we wondered if they would be able to survive on their own. And what we found out was that yes, they were. And they're born in the den, the nest is already prepared when they're there, and yet these bears that we released were making preparing nests and doing all that. And we figured, well, how do they know that? Well, from this camera information, what we learned is the females, after they're born, teaches them how to bring materials into the den and build a nest. This is all in March, April, late in the spring, just before they leave. And the top two is a female with a yearling, and she's pulling back. It's hard to tell, but she's pulling back some vegetation back across. That was a ledge that actually dropped off about 100 feet. But she was pulling material back there, and then later it shows the yearling. And then the one on the bottom was a cub that she was bringing branches back into the nest, and the cub was kind of paying attention, I think. And this is the same series. There was over 100 or a couple hundred pictures in this. But this cub was pretty ambitious. It'd go out, and she'd go get it and bring it back, first time by the neck. Second time it went out, looks like she was yelling at it. That's her with her mouth open. And then she goes out and grabs it by the rear end and pulls it back into the den. And each day, this was kind of a ritual that was going on with this female. But she was teaching it to bring materials back into the den. The other information we've been able to get with telemetry is some really good information on success and movements of our transplants. This is the first year of information that we had on our release of mountain goats on the LaSalle. And you can see at the top that most of those animals stayed in one one particular area, pretty close to where they were released, but then we had some that moved some long distances and kind of checked out the country and then moved back and stayed back in the areas where they started. So this was great information that sometimes in the past when we did transplants, we didn't know where they went, we didn't know their survival, and so this has been very, very helpful in determining the success of some of these transplants. We recently did, I assume most of you have heard, we transplanted 50 bighorns from Zion National Park to the North San Juan. The North San Juan had a disease event back in the early 80s, and we've watched this herd just be stagnant for 30 years with very few animals, very low survival. So we got these animals, we put another video that's probably not going to play. Give it a shot. Okay. We had 25 of them, half of them that had GPS radios on, and so we've been able to monitor those and watch their movements, monitor survival. And the other day, Dustin Mitchell was out, went down. There was a cluster of them that was near a canyon where he could get to and observe, and he went out, and there were 10 ewes with 8 lambs. So it looks like initially we've got some pretty good success with that. And all, like I said, all this information is because of the money that we've had to be able to do these kinds of projects and get this kind of information, which hopefully makes us better managers and make better decisions on our management. So that's all I have. The one thing I was going to say, I kind of covered a lot of different projects. If anybody wants more specific information on any of these, please feel free to call our biologist and talk to our biologist. They're pretty intimate with these studies, and so they can answer questions. If the RAC would like sometime, we can make a presentation on a specific aspect of any of these, if anybody would like. And so I'd encourage you to do that or ask questions during the RAC meetings about any of this information, because we do use this information quite a bit, and it does play a part in our recommendations.
Questions?
Close to the mic.
Oh, I do not know why my computer. Okay. Everything went really small. Okay, so I'll try and keep this as brief as possible. So in the habitat section, it's not working. Let me go back. Anyway, I'll just start talking. So we're over our wildlife management areas, the Watershed Restoration Initiative. We do a lot of work with our Guzzler projects, and then we do a lot of the work on the wildlife crossing structures that we have. So we have 7 WMAs in the region, a little over 32,000 acres, and a lot of the purpose for those is wildlife habitat, recreation for the public. We maintain water rights on those. We control noxious weeds. So this is part of that collar study. This is a little bit biased because a lot of where we've captured some of the deer and elk that we've collared have been near Gordon Creek, but this just kind of shows some of the hotspot areas that deer have been using during the winter since the collars have been put in place. That spot that was squared off, those are our Gordon Creek fields, so you can see there's a lot of use in our Gordon Creek wildlife management area. It's a really important area for wintering wildlife, and it's one of the properties that we actively farm. This just is some pictures of what we do. That's our maintenance guy, Matt, planting the fields, and then just the progression of growth in the fields over time. And then these are some of the wildlife. The top picture is kind of hard to see, but that's a rooster pheasant. And you can just see the numbers of deer that are using those fields. Turkeys, elk, deer. We have a variety of wildlife that use those fields, and they're really important during the wintertime. This isn't an animation or anything, but this, if it doesn't pull up, this is just kind of a picture of the different collars that have used the Gordon Creek fields and where those go on the Manti. So I don't know why it's not pulling up, but we might just skip that for now. So habitat improvements, this slide you already saw previously on what's been done through WRI in the region. From 2005 to 2018, we've had $32 million put into habitat projects, and $25 million has been through partner funds and $5 million through in-kind. We've treated over 150,000 acres on terrestrial areas, and then our riparian areas, we've treated 13,000. So we've done a lot of work in the region, and a lot of that funding comes from a lot of our sportsmen's groups and through Habitat Council, which is licensed dollars. So you can kind of see a breakdown of all the money that we've gotten and how many acres of treatments those funds have been used for in the region. One project that I'm just going to highlight is the Miller Creek project. We were tasked to do a watershed scale project, and in Miller Creek, This crosses land ownership boundaries. It's doing work on the uplands and in the riparian areas, so it's a really good all-encompassing project. 378 acres have already been treated on crucial winter range. We've done beaver dam analog structures, and these are basically in areas that are either not good for beaver because of nuisance issues, or in areas where the current habitat wouldn't support beaver because there's not enough vegetation. In this area specifically, there wasn't enough riparian vegetation, and so hopefully building up the floodplain and then having some of that water hit the side of the riparian area will allow some willows to grow, and then it'll improve the riparian area there. A lot of what had happened in this area was the Sealy Fire. Just a lot of the erosion came down, and there was a lot of sediment, and that scoured out a lot of the Miller Creek area. You can see, it's kind of hard to see in that picture, but some of the scour areas in the upper elevations are over 30 feet deep. So in the next year, we're going to be doing a lot of stream restoration on those portions and then doing 1,000 more acres of pinyon juniper removal. And another part of this project that's been kind of cool is we've released quail in the project area as well as turkeys. And then part of this project, Justin mentioned this earlier, the project area is there in the purple. You can see that deer that moved from Duchesne and spent its life in the Hiawatha project, and it was recently hit by a car, but it was kind of a cool story of what that deer did. And then this is kind of the use of the deer in the project area. The green is stuff that's already been treated, and then the blue is future treatment. So you can see how the deer are really using those project areas that have already been treated. Next, wildlife crossing structures. So we've done phase one of a big crossing structure in Monticello. It's had its fair share of issues, but you just got to remember with some of these projects, they cost a lot of money, and we've got to go in phases. So the first phase, we did 3.5 miles of fence, one structure, 9 double cattle guards, 30 gates, and 10 escape ramps. And then SFW helped us out a lot with that project by funding the cattle guards. And then we had dedicated hunter help with some of the fencing. Patty Kramer, she's a researcher who does a lot of the research throughout the state on wildlife crossing structures, said that she's never seen the numbers of deer that are using the current crossing structure that we installed. And so although there's been issues with deer crossing the double cattle guards, phase two should help with that. Phase two should reduce another 300 vehicle collisions per year. It should reduce the pressure on the fence and double cattle guards. We'll be installing 3 additional crossing structures, and this will connect phase one with the Devil's Canyon project, which was 3 crossings that had been installed in 2005. So it should be better connected. We should know if we get funding from this from UDOT in the next month or so. And then last thing I'm going to talk about is guzzlers. We have over 165 guzzlers in the region. They're used for a variety of species from deer, elk, pronghorn, bighorn sheep, sage grouse, and chukar. Our bighorn sheep, we have an agreement with the BLM. So bighorn sheep and pronghorn, we have a seasonal who's co-managed by the BLM and the state. He maintains a lot of our guzzlers, and it's been really beneficial for us to have that partnership. And then we have sheep that use them, adorable lambs. So, and then next, our next phase of projects for maintenance, we're going to try and prioritize areas for guzzlers, because sometimes with that many guzzlers across the state, it can be hard to maintain them. So our next area of focus for the next year, which we have funding for, is to maintain and repair 10 guzzlers in the San Rafael Desert. So you can kind of see where that's located there. And then last year, we did 5 guzzlers for chukar on Burma Road, which is near Huntington. And so we had a lot of volunteers and help from Chukar Foundation and even some Bristol hunting dog groups to come help us with that. And the chukars used it all summer long. That picture's really hard to see in this lighting, but the chukars really used that project. And then for the sake of time, I was going to show a video of the chukar transplant, but I think we should move on. So that's all we have for that.
Are there any questions? this point, we'll bring up Martin to do wildlife implications of new state and county resource management plans.
For those of you that don't know me, my name's Marty Bushman. I'm an assistant attorney general that works with the Division of Wildlife Resources, and here today to present an informational item on a matter that's raised some questions about the interplay between county resource management plans and the Division of Wildlife Resources Authority to manage wildlife. So in 2016, the Utah legislature enacted a statute that directed counties to prepare comprehensive resource management plans, and in those plans, they were to address a number of topics, but some of them included things such as predator control, wildlife, fisheries, and threatened and endangered species. And although the plans do address this, the RMPs were not intended by the legislature to control or supersede the division's authority to manage wildlife, but to provide guidance to the division and issues that it's related with and working on, and that also implicate counties. In the act itself that directed counties to prepare the plans, it stated that in this part would be construed to limit the authority of the state to manage and protect wildlife under Title 23 of the Wildlife Resources Code of Utah. So to kind of understand that savings clause, it's going to just give you a quick overview of the authorities that are given in statute to the Division of Wildlife, to the Regional Advisory Councils, and to the Wildlife Board to help provide some context to that statement there. So first of all, in the Wildlife Code, the Division is designated as trustee and custodian of protected wildlife. All wildlife within the state falls within the jurisdiction of the division, whether it's on private or public land. And then lastly, the division, subject to the policymaking authority of the Wildlife Board, is directed to protect, propagate, manage, conserve, and distribute protected wildlife throughout the state. And while there's a lot of other statutes that direct the division, these are the ones that capsulize the general responsibilities the best. And then for regional advisory councils, there's also statutory direction on what the role of the councils are. And that is to hear broad input, recommendations, biological data, and information regarding the effects of wildlife, to gather information from staff, the public, and the governmental agencies, and then to make recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board is charged to establish the policies that are best designed to accomplish the purposes and fulfill the intent of all laws pertaining to wildlife and the preservation, protection, conservation, perpetuation, introduction, and management of wildlife. As the Wildlife Board develops policies, there is a number of things that the board is directed to consider. One is to recognize that wildlife is an essential to a healthy environment, to recognize the economic impacts of wildlife on private property and local communities, seek to balance the habitat requirements of wildlife with social and economic activities of man, to recognize the social and economic values of wildlife, to seek to maintain wildlife on a sustainable basis, and then as it considers all these things, to consider the recommendations of the regional advisory councils. There is also some statutory direction in the Wildlife Code relating to translocations, and that directs that any time the division is going to translocate big game, turkeys, wolves, or sensitive species, has to be in accordance with a plan. That plan has to address the proposed transplant sites or identify where they are. That plan has to be vetted with or reviewed and sought input from potentially affected landowners, local government officials, and then lastly, the Resource Development Coordinating Committee. Once that information is gathered, plans submitted to the regional advisory councils, particularly the one that's in the region that's affected by this translocation plan, and for the regional advisory councils to make recommendations to the wildlife board. And then finally, the plan has to be approved by the wildlife board, and that's the statutory process that the legislature set up for translocations. One other area deals with management plans. The legislature's given some direction on how those are to be prepared and under what circumstances. The statute, interestingly, only explicitly applies to deer and elk, although the division uses this format for virtually of all of its management plans, whether they're deer, elk, or any other species. But there, that the plans are to establish target herd sizes and objectives, to consider the range carrying capacity of the unit, seek to balance relevant multiple uses of the range, and to seek and consider input from federal and state land managers, private landowners, sportsmen, and ranchers. The plans are presented to the regional advisory councils for recommendation to the board, and then ultimate plan must be approved by the wildlife board, and that's the statutory process under the wildlife code for creating management plans. Now back to the county resource management plans. Some of these resource management plans express positions on wildlife management matters, including things like population objectives, management plans, and translocations. Now, the division, the regional advisory councils, and the wildlife board should carefully consider and weigh those positions when making recommendations that implicate them. But the RMPs do not control or bind the state and the division when exercising its wildlife management authority under Title 23. It's under the statute that created or directed counties to create resource management plans. There was the statement is that it would not be construed to limit the authority of the division under the Wildlife Resources Code. The state also took all the county plans and created a state plan, and it was just passed and accepted by the legislature this past session. It too addresses predator control, wildlife fisheries, and threatened and endangered species. But the plan, however, is very clear. It reaffirms and recognizes the division's authority to manage wildlife in the RAC and Regional Advisory Council process for developing policy. It states in the plan that the process for determining the balance among competing uses and establishing the best fishery and wildlife management policies is declared in state law through the RAC and Wildlife Board process. So in conclusion, just the takeaway from this, with these plans is, first is that the RACs, the Wildlife Board and Division, need to evaluate and seriously consider the objectives and goals that are stated in these resource management plans by the counties when they're making decisions that are affecting those particular matters. However, the final decision, when made, is made pursuant to the Wildlife Code and under the processes that are defined and set forth in that. And that concludes the little informational presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond. You were wowed. All right.
So, I was involved with one of the county plans, and the takeaway that I'm getting from you is that it's nice to have the plan in place. It was established, it was mandated by the legislature, and all the counties did it. But it seems like what you're saying is that even though those plans exist, they're advisory to the Wildlife Board, and they really don't have any importance as far as decisions that the division would make on a particular issue.
The legislature didn't direct the counties to make these plans as a vehicle for counties to manage wildlife. I mean, that was not the intent. The intent was the state still manages the wildlife. But among the many interests and different matters they address in these plans, there were some wildlife issues, and it becomes an important document for the division and those that make decisions through the RAC and board process to understand what those county objectives are and to seriously consider them. But again, under our government, you know, the state is the primary form of government. Counties are political subdivisions, and It was not the legislature's intent that resource management plans become kind of a de facto tool for managing wildlife. Is that responding?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so next we have wild turkey recommendations and rule amendments. Jason.
I'm Avery Cook, Upland Game Project Leader with the Utah Division of Wildlife. I'm filling in tonight for Jason Robinson on the Upland Game and Wild Turkey Guidebook Rules and Recommendations for the 2018-19 guidebook. So I'll start with just a little background on this proposed rule change. So we are just finishing the first year of a three-year guidebook cycle, so the Upland Game regulations are typically approved once every 3 years for a little more stability year to year in what is in the guidebook. So the majority of the Upland Game rule changes were done last year. Tonight we're just looking at a few specific changes to the turkey rules. So the turkey populations are doing very well in Utah. They've been on an upward trend consistently over the years with a few dips related to some hard winters, but the long-term trend is up and continuing up. However, those upward trends create a few concerns in some places with human-turkey interactions and some nuisance and depredation problems. So the main motivation to these rule changes proposing tonight is to propose some actions to increase hunting opportunities and alleviate some of these turkey nuisance and depredation concerns. So these proposed rule changes would affect the years 2 and 3 of the three-year guidebook. Just to go into a little background on the strategy behind managing turkey hunts in Utah. We primarily evaluate them on three metrics, three-year average hunt success. We try and keep that above 20%. A three-year average perceived hunter crowding on a 1 to 5 scale, we try and keep that below 4. And a three-year average hunter satisfaction, we try and keep that above 2 on a 1 to 5 scale. So just looking at the spring turkey permit data, so this is both the limited entry and general season combined. We've got, again, a general upward trend. That spike you see in 2009-2010 is right when we introduced the over-the-counter general season hunt. So we had a spike in permits then, and then a decrease after that, which is pretty common with the first introduction of a unlimited over-the-counter hunt. You get a lot of people interested in the first year, and interest wanes a little bit following years, and then usually slowly picks up again. So again, our total permits are trending up along with our population, and harvest generally follows that with some variation due to weather and other factors each year. So looking at three-year hunt success, again, our target is to keep hunt success over 20%, averaging between the over-the-counter and the limited entry. We're at 32%, with the limited entry significantly higher than the over-the-counter hunt success. Hunter crowding, again, we've got trending upwards for our hunter numbers and our population. So that blue line is kind of hunters afield, so we've got increases in hunters each year, but the perceived crowding is pretty stable, and I think that's a result of increasing populations, distributing people throughout the state, and still having a pretty unimpeded, uncrowded hunt generally. Again, the spring hunter satisfaction is pretty stable over the years, fluctuates slightly, but again, well exceeding our target of the 2 out of 5 on the results from the hunter survey with the average of 3.9. Again, that's for both the limited entry and over-the-counter. So in the 2014-15 season, we had our first fall hunt that we've implemented for quite a few years. The permits are, again, trending up with the population, and the harvest is kind of following along with some year-to-year variation based on what the population's doing, winter weather the previous years, and other factors specific to each region. The wild turkey hunt success for the fall season, again, not a lot of years with trend data, but generally a pretty high success hunt. We're up around the first year, we're over 75%, and we're still hovering between 50 and 60% hunt success, so generally a very successful hunt. Again, over the years, the crowding and satisfactions remain pretty stable with very high satisfaction and very low perceived crowding in the fall hunt. So well within our management goals. With all that said, again, we've got those increased populations, which is great for the most part, but we are experiencing some of those depredation and nuisance concerns in some areas. So after all the other measures we're taking as far as damage and mitigation plans, hazing birds off property, trying to bait them off property, trying to get some habitat projects in, and moving birds. Last year we trapped and transplanted over 2,100 birds, which gives us a great source population to get turkeys out in areas they haven't been before, but kind of up against our manpower limits to a degree of the number of birds we're able to trap and transplant. So we're looking at making some changes to the fall hunt where we can reduce populations in some key areas where they're causing problems. So the fall hunt will generally remain the same for the vast majority of the structure. It'll still be over-the-counter, first-come, first-serve. However, there is a cap by region, so each region sets a quota for the fall hunt from zero to whatever is appropriate for the population levels. So each region then within a region sets small hunt boundaries, and those hunt boundaries are very targeted to areas of human-wildlife conflict with turkeys. The one change here is we're proposing to move the opening date a month earlier to October 1st. It is currently November 1st. And that is just the maximum framework. So each region can set their hunt dates anywhere within that open to close. So most of the regions set it a slightly shorter period, but within that framework of the maximum length. There's still going to be no point system, no bonus points or preference points. Again, it's just an over-the-counter hunt with a cap on the maximum number of permits that can be sold. There's a 15% allocation for youth hunters. And the other change here is currently there's a limit of one fall turkey tag per hunter, and we're proposing to change that to three. The idea behind that is these hunts are designed to reduce populations in key areas, and if we've got hunters that are being successful, we'd like those hunters to continue removing turkeys. So specifically to rule R657.54, the taking of wild turkeys, we're also making some general changes to this. The first one is change the weapon regulations to any shotgun firing BB and smaller diameter shot. So the reasoning behind this change is there's a tungsten super shot, TSS shot, that's becoming more prevalent on the market, and it's a ultra-dense metal to make shot out of, and you can basically get the same stopping power, hitting power, energy in the like a number 9 BB as you would in a much larger lead pellet. So people are able to like hunt turkey with 410s shooting nines. So this rule changes to accommodate changes in weapons technology. We're also proposing to allow rimfire weapons for the fall turkey hunt only. So there would be no change for rimfire on the spring hunt. And this is, again, this fall hunt is very much a management hunt. And by allowing rimfire, we'd hope to bring in some people that normally wouldn't be able to hunt the fall hunt. It's great for younger youth, smaller youth that aren't really able to fire a typical turkey load out of a 12-gauge. And also just allow people to reach out a little further in some of these problem areas where the turkeys are out in the open but depredating people's crop fields or other areas. Also, again, a general simplification on our number of permits. We've got quite a few categories of different permits currently, and we're just simplifying limits, basically one spring and three fall. And those three fall would be the fall general season, depredation or turkey control voucher, or a depredation hunt permit. And conservation permits would not be included in those quotas. For Rule 657-69, turkey depredation, again, just being consistent across the different rules for turkey, simplifying it to three fall permits per hunter, so all general season depredation and control permit vouchers, the landowner control permits, the free permits given to landowners, and conservation tags, again, would not be included in that quota. Thank you.
Okay, at this point we'll take questions from the rack. I have quite a few.
A few of them.
Okay, great.
The limited entry areas, is this to be implemented statewide, the three tags?
Three fall tags?
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a fall hunt, though, right?
Yeah, so each region does not necessarily have a fall hunt. This would just allow a hunter three fall tags. Each region can, at their discretion, assign fall hunt units in those fall hunt boundaries with a quota per region.
Okay, so the southeast region, that's a pretty big region.
Right now we only have a little farm in Hanksville. Is the only place you can hunt fall turkeys in the southeast, correct?
Yeah, there's just that one unit.
I mean,
with
the vast majority
few tags.
Of the southeast, it wouldn't affect at all.
Correct.
Okay, that helps clarify. I wasn't sure if it was going to be broken down into smaller units within the southeast region or just the entire southeast region.
Yeah, so all of the fall units are small targeted units in areas where we're having nuisance or depredation problems, and we've tried other methods to alleviate those problems before going to the lethal control.
Next question. On the shot size, how come you limit it to BB and not buckshot? Is there a reason for that?
I guess typically you are shooting a turkey in the head rather than body shot. And it
I agree,
reasonable shot. Basically, we changed one end of the spectrum. We didn't change the BB end, so we're changed the small end for the tungsten super shot, but didn't.
If you're going to open it up to rimfire, why put the restriction on the shot size?
It's a valid point. We basically were just addressing one half of that shot size restriction. So.
And the last question is concerning safety with the rimfire. I know we hunt small game and rabbits with rimfire all the time, but in certain areas I could see a high potential for safety considerations using a rimfire. They're pretty prone for ricochet.
Does the division have any concerns with that?
I think there's concerns with safety for basically any firearm you're using. During that time of the year, there's, like you said, other centerfire big game hunts going, small game hunts, different bird hunts, shotgun hunts. So we don't see this as particularly more dangerous than any of the other hunts. It really goes back to the responsibility of the hunter knowing their target and what's beyond.
Okay, that's all I have.
Are there any other questions from the rack?
I just had one question. In your rule change with control permits for turkeys, it mentions that rimfires may be used as a legal weapon for control permits. So is that any season? If you have a turkey control permit, you can use a rimfire anytime?
Yeah, so part of that is basically for fall hunts, and we've defined fall hunts as a calendar period, so any hunts in that fall period, you'd be able to use a rimfire, including a control permit tag.
Is that... I guess it was just more of a technical question because it specifically relates to control permits. So the way I read that part of the code was if you have a control permit, you could use a rimfire any time.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, on a control permit.
Sorry, yeah, it's in – that part's in the depredation rule and taking turkey. So the – taking wild turkey rule is defined as a fall hunt, and then the depredation rule, you can use it for the control permits. So.
I just had a question. Can you clarify the dates? Because you see August 1st to March 1st, or March 14th, and then you also see the October to February. So I was just curious.
So the fall general season would be proposed to be November 1st, or October 1st to February 28th within the larger guidelines. Control permit vouchers can be issued from August 1st to March 14th. And a depredation hunt can also be implemented anytime August 1st to March 14th. Is that?
If there's no more questions from the rack, we'll take questions from the audience. Are there any questions? Comments from the audience, I don't think. Okay, we don't have any comments. So, we do. Thank you. Okay, we have Kevin Norman.
Kevin Norman from SFW. We support the division's recommendations as presented. We just ask that we keep in mind the option of transplanting turkeys in these problem areas. Keep that in mind that we don't need to wipe them out. There's other options. Also, why I'm here, I'd like to speak as a dad of a 9-year-old princess at home. I think the rimfire option is a wonderful option for kids. There's no way I would put her behind a 12-gauge shotgun or any shotgun of that matter and let her get punished by shooting a turkey. I think... She's not as tough as you, Eric. I think it provides tremendous opportunity for youth to have a good experience on a turkey hunt at a young age. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good feedback. Okay, so at this point, let's take comments from the rack.
I'll start.
Great. And I'll oppose you. I'm joking.
Okay. No, yeah. Somebody's got to do it.
No, it's great.
With regard to the rule change to allow rim fires for turkeys, I had exactly two people contact me that opposed it, and I talked to a whole bunch of people that were in favor of it. So I went ahead and I contacted some folks in Colorado and Wyoming. Wyoming is pretty lax about what guns they allow to be used. You can use pretty much any firearm you want to use to hunt any game you want to hunt in Wyoming. This includes upland birds and everything. If you want to use a .30-06 to shoot pine hens, knock yourself out. I wouldn't advocate for that. But Colorado's rule is kind of similar to what the division is proposing. Within certain areas and certain situations, their fall season, they allow rim fires. And they haven't had any problems. And, you know, the people I talk to like it a lot, especially with regard to youth hunters. There's a lot of kids that want to go out and hunt. But like the gentleman said, you've got 9-10-year-old kids that if you want to chase them away from hunting, set them down on the ground with a 12-gauge shotgun with a 3-inch shell in it. I can promise you that kid will never hunt again. They'll hate it. It's going to hurt them and scare them. So the idea of allowing them another opportunity to hunt turkeys with a gun that they can manage is probably a good one. And they haven't had any safety problems outside of normal issues with people hunting and using guns anyway. And like the division mentioned, you have, you know, the ultimate safety responsibility is up to the individual. And then I had... Also, I don't know how we want to handle this. I got a letter from an individual requesting some changes in the division to look at the timing of the draw hunts in the spring with regard to the turkeys. We have two varieties. We have Miriams and Rios, both in Utah. And the Miriams tend to be more of a mountain higher elevation bird, and the Rios live in the riparian areas, primarily along rivers and streams and in farmland. And this brought up something, so I had to look into it and find out that it is actually the case. The birds living in the higher elevations strut later. And the birds living down lower in the valleys, it warms up sooner, they strut earlier. And the concern with this individual was having the hunt was moved back, it's later now, and trying to hunt the Rios, they're pretty much done strutting by the time the hunt starts, and it's a limited entry hunt. So there was concern about that, and the request, my takeaway from the letter was that, you know, the crest was try to move the hunt to where it kind of straddles both, so you have an opportunity to hunt strutting birds, you know, if you're down low. This year there was no snow or anything, so access to the high country where the Miriams are at was probably not an issue, but there could be years where you couldn't access them very easily. And I don't know how do you want to handle that. Do we make that like a motion, we ask the wildlife board to put it on an action log, or what? How do you want to address that?
I don't know. Do you want to respond to that, Avery, or?
As far as the board process, I'll leave that up to the board chair. But
as far as whether that observation is correct or not about timing and Rios.
Yeah, generally, yeah, that is accurate. Specifically, where the dates in individual areas, I don't have great information on that. But yeah, typically the Rios will be earlier than the Miriams.
And the limited entry hunt is missing that opportunity.
Again, I don't have exact dates, but it's certainly plausible. Yeah.
You requested an action log item to the board, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. What I can do, Trish, I can bring that up
as we get motions.
As we get motions, we can work at it then.
Okay. All right. So let's take other comments.
I have one. I guess just the wording of the... As I read through the way it was worded, it was concerning to me because it sounded like it's pretty much, and I think there was some clarification that they're not doing it statewide. You know, it is broken down, but does there need to be some wording in there that discusses that, to where it's not opened up statewide? I don't know if that's necessary or not, but it is a concern for me, because here in the southeast region, I mean, there are certain areas in the southeast region that are thriving, but they're very small areas, and the biggest part of that this region is the birds are just barely starting to gain some momentum. So I see potential with the fall hunt and the rimfire rifles. You could wipe out one of these flocks in small areas in a real short time. So
okay.
I guess I don't know that I have a motion or anything, but I would like that to be considered, whether it be by the division or the Wildlife Board, if there needs to be wording to that effect.
Is that verbiage already in the guidebook?
Yeah, so the regulation is statewide, but it gives the region discretion for the fall hunts, so there won't be any fall hunts in a region or in an area unless there is a overpopulation concern. So there wouldn't be an opportunity for a fall hunt or rimfire in an area where the populations weren't having issues with overabundance.
I guess my comment is, I'm glad you brought that information about the rimfire from other states. So that helps me, because I was fairly opposed to it. Even though I will state, the first time I killed a turkey, it did flip me over backwards. So even as an adult, I had that pain. But I guess what I appreciate about a hunting turkey with a shotgun, it really promotes that fair chase. And having to really get close to a bird. And I actually think that's a great way to introduce youth to hunting. And turkeys are hard to hunt. So I appreciate that. I'm not opposed to the rimfire idea with that information. What concerns me is, if we have a 20% hunt success and we're all happy with that, we're meeting those objectives. Can we tiptoe into this idea of rimfire by allowing that but going, maybe we stay at one fall turkey, but giving rimfire? For me to go rimfire and three turkeys, that's a little concerning to me, because your hunt success is going to be way higher, and all of a sudden you've tripled a person's ability to kill a turkey. So I just want to throw that idea out.
I agree with you, and if you go back to the slides, the fall, correct me if I'm wrong, but the fall hunt was about a 75% success.
Okay, I didn't see that.
The spring hunt was 20%, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
So you add the rimfire and you could potentially
decimate a population.
Now, I really like what Kevin suggested, and I hope that the division remains open to that, because there are a lot of areas, right here is one of them, in the southeast region that we would love to see more, some of the turkeys brought from these overpopulated areas and help our flocks out. So there's other opportunity there rather than just wiping them out.
I think part of it was, correct me if I'm wrong, because some of the wording was vague, I agree with Eric, but it was to target small populations that have become a nuisance. Is that what it was intent was, the three permits allowing people to take three birds either sex? It's just to target localized populations that are becoming a problem because they're way too many?
That's correct. And this is kind of we've got a lot of other tools in our toolbox as far as raising and moving birds. And we've basically just put these fall hunts in places where we've kind of reached our trapping capacity. Last year, we moved over 2,000 turkeys from some of these overpopulated areas.
So we are moving them. One other comment I would make pursuant to moving turkeys, I can't speak to everywhere in the southeast region, but I can speak to the Colorado and Green River corridors, and moving turkeys here ain't going to do you any good. We're overrun with raccoons, skunks, and red foxes, and they get the nests. I don't see quail anymore.
So we've got habitat problems?
I mean, except where I live along the river and stuff, I used to have turkeys, quail, occasionally a pheasant, but pheasants are not, They are their own issue. But, you know, I have, my garden is raided constantly all summer by raccoons. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon the other day, I had a red fox in the corral with my horses. And I didn't used to see foxes in the daylight. So, if, you know, I like the idea of moving the turkeys and building populations, but I guess my comment is that I would encourage the division to look at predator control programs and some kind of scorched earth policy with raccoons riparian areas before we spend money putting turkeys there that are just going to get their eggs destroyed.
Valid concern.
I just kind of want to second what Trish said. I mean, that's what I think too. And I understand it is just for targeted areas, but we're saying you can kill triple and you can do it a lot easier. Seems like let's maybe do one or the other first, see how it goes, and then go from there. And then the next one's the coyote bounty, so maybe you can lump raccoons in there.
Okay. So at this point, do we want to entertain a motion, or do we want to accept the proposal as is?
I would like to, I guess, make a motion about the season dates. I'll try to get this right. I'd like to make a motion that we ask the Wildlife Board to look at the timing of the spring limited entry turkey seasons to maybe move it to where it spans the strut for both Miriams and Rios and gives kind of an equal opportunity on both subspecies.
Okay, so yeah, I think so.
Okay.
So we have a motion by Kent for the Wildlife Board to consider an action item.
An action log item.
Yeah. An action log item.
Yeah.
In which they'll look at the timing of limited entry turkey seasons to straddle both subspecies. Do I have a second on that? I have a second by Kirk. All in favor? I have just, and then all opposed. And then you're abstaining. Is that right, Garish? So other than Garish, it was unanimous. Am I saying that correctly? Garish. So do I have another motion?
Want me to take a stab at it?
Go ahead.
Okay. Make a motion to accept the remainder of the division's proposals with the exception that we remain at one turkey per hunter on the fall hunts. Does that work for everybody? Doing either or on that?
I'd rather see keep the three tags because we're at either six. Hold off on there because in his comments, he said you can use a 410 now shooting number nine shot with that denser load. Any kid can handle that. And so I'd rather see the additional tags and not the rimfire, if that was okay with you, your motion. Just personal preference.
Motion withdrawn.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Go ahead.
Now you're up. You're like, go around.
Make a motion to accept the remainder of the proposals with the exception of the addition of a rimfire rifle. Hold off on that and see how we go with the traditional.
Okay, so I have a motion by Jace to accept the division's proposal as presented with the exception of the use of rimfire weapons in fall turkey hunts. Is that correct? Am I saying that correct? Do I have a second on that?
Second.
Okay, I have a second, but it doesn't matter. Helene, all in favor? I think I have 8 in favor and all opposed. 3 opposed. Okay, great. And I think we're good because we accepted everything except for that exception, right? Right? So. We're moving on. Nice job. So now we have Coyote Bounty Program Amendments. How do you say your name?
Jayla.
Jayla. like that.
We should have made you try to say it.
School teacher, come on.
You would have given me that. Where did your parents come up with that?
Excuse me for just a second. Slaughtered that.
That went well. That was nice. How are we doing? It's okay. Probably good, hopefully. Yeah, okay. So I'm Jayla Walden. I am a predator management specialist for the Division of Wildlife, and I will be talking about the proposed rule amendments to Rule 657-64, and it pertains to the Predator Control Program. So a little bit of background on the program. It was initiated back in 2012 under the Mule Deer Protection Act, and the purpose of the program is to protect non-predatory wildlife, and it's specifically geared towards protecting mule deer. The way the program works is legislation allocates funding annually to the division, and then the division runs the program and provides a cash incentive of $50 to participants for every coyote that they remove from within the state of Utah. To qualify to become a participant, members of the public go online and take an online education course. Once they complete the course, they become a participant in the program. And then to receive payment for coyotes, they are required to submit the scalp and lower jaw of each coyote, along with a compensation form, which provides information such as the date, the method of take, the location, and the sex of each coyote that they remove. So a quick overview of the proposed changes. We are first recommending requiring a COR to participate in the program. Second, we are recommending standardizing what condition we accept our samples in. Third, we are recommending having the ability to alter our payments based on where we came in relationship to the budget of the previous fiscal year. And fourth, we are recommending the requiring participants to use an electronic application to participate. So the first recommendation we have is requiring a certificate of registration to participate in the program. Participants aren't really going to see much of a change with this. So when they complete the education course currently, it prints off this page we have on the left-hand side of the screen, and currently it provides a registration number. This is just going to change to a COR number instead of a registration number. The difference participants will see is they will have to renew this annually. So every 365 days, they have to go back in and retake the course. And this is actually already currently in policy. We just haven't been following it in practice so far. And we want to be following this in practice because it's really important that participants are familiar with rules and other important information that we provide in the training. And also, it holds participants accountable for the information that we expect of them. And then additionally, CORs typically have a fee associated with them. For the simplicity of this program, we are going to be waiving the fee because we don't want guys having to come in and pay to participate in the program and then get paid. So the next recommendations we propose to make refer to the types of samples that come in through the program. First, the current rule currently states that participants must have taken the coyotes that they are submitting. We are proposing to change the word taken throughout the entire rule to the word killed because there's a lot of ambiguity around the word taken. Taking can be understood as the word possession, and so this creates an issue with guys going out and collecting roadkill, which is not beneficial to mule deer or other wildlife. And then on top of that, it makes it hard for law enforcement to hold cases when the wording is taken over the word killed. The next proposals we have refer to the actual scalp and lower jaws that participants are submitting.
We propose that they are not rotten or spoiled and also do not have maggots or carrion organisms on them. And this is because we need to have biologists and technicians who are checking in the coyotes be able to confidently ID the samples as coyotes. And then the last thing that goes along with this is the current rule states that the lower jaw must include the canines, and we propose to extend that out to the premolars because we collect the first premolar on the jaw. And we've been doing that since the beginning of the program, so we just want the policy or the rule to match what we're actually doing. The next recommendations we are making is having the ability to alter the payments based on where we are in relationship to our allotted budget in the previous fiscal year. So we recommend being able to decrease payments $5 per coyote in a following fiscal year when the preceding year we exhausted our entire budget. And then in years that we don't exhaust the entire budget, we would increase it $5 up to the maximum of $50 per coyote when we remain below the budget in previous years. And so the way this would work is, say this fiscal year we spend all of our appropriated money, we would then bump the payment down to $45. If we still stayed below it, we would bump it down to $40. If we were then remaining below we weren't exhausting our budget, we would bump it back up to $45. And if we stayed below it again, we'd bump it back up to $50. So it would just fluctuate from year to year based on whether we spent all of our money in the previous year. And this is really a proactive approach to managing the budget, because as the program continues, we've seen an increase in the number of payments we are making and the number of coyotes that we've received. And as you can see in the graph, we started out well below $400,000 paying out annually, and last fiscal year we paid $575,000, and then this year we're up to a little over $500,000 currently. And then along with that, we recommend requiring participants to submit coyotes within 1 year of the kill date, and this is for two reasons. First, it's hard to assess how effective the program is if participants are storing up coyotes for 3 or 4 years in their freezer and we don't know how many coyotes are actually coming in a timely manner. And then second, it's a way to prevent participants from storing up coyotes in, say, years that the payment's only $40 or $45 and holding on to them until the payment's back up to $50, and then we have a huge influx of coyotes and then we exhaust our budget very early in the fiscal year. The last recommendation we are making is requiring participants to use a electronic application to participate in the program. The way that electronic application is going to work is it'll replace the paper compensation forms that participants currently submit. This isn't going to replace having to go in and check in the scalp and lower jaw. Participants will still have to go in and submit there. However, it'll make it more efficient for participants because they will no longer have to figure out where the locations are that they're hunting. And in my experience, most of our participants don't carry a GPS out in the field with them. They're going out, they're removing their coyotes, they go back home and they have to sit down on the computer and try to figure out where they were hunting, or they have to pull out a hard copy map and try to pinpoint where the locations are that they remove their coyotes from. And the way the application is going to work is participants will download it onto a smartphone device which has the ability to take their location and take pictures. They will enter in a new report, and then they will enter in all the same information except for the location data. It'll then ask them to take a picture of the coyote exactly where they removed it from or where they killed it at. And then it'll automatically upload into a database. If they don't have service, it'll save the report, and participants can go back later when they do have service and submit it at that time. It'll also be more efficient and accurate for the division's reporting. We are currently trying to assess how effective the program is, and it's difficult to do so without accurate information, and this will provide exact coordinates of where every coyote is removed from. Also, it reduces a lot of time on our end. Biologists and technicians spend a lot of time taking all of these hard copy forms and entering them into databases, and along the way we get typos or Handwriting is difficult to read, and sometimes participants don't have a good understanding of how GPS coordinates work, and so they give us coordinates that aren't real coordinates, and so it makes it difficult to collect data this way. And this is just going to completely eliminate that issue. And then on top of that, the application is really intended to reduce fraud in the program. There are open cases in all of our regions currently where participants are either suspected of or are being charged with turning in coyotes from out of state. And this has been a concern that's been addressed with us from sportsmen's groups, and so we're using this application as a way to help reduce this issue. And then kind of to piggyback on this, there's a lot of participants who don't feel comfortable giving us exact coordinates of where they're removing their coyotes from because they don't want their hunting spots or their trap lines not being protected or being exploited. And so we are proposing to extend out our privacy protection policy to provide protection from public disclosure at the participants' requests from giving out their coyote removal locations. And this would be provided under Utah Code 63G2305. And then along with that, currently we provide an annual report with a map that looks like the one up in the left-hand corner where we actually plot all of the points on the map. And we are going to be shifting this to a density map, which is shown similarly to that on the right-hand corner, where it just shows hot spots of where lots of coyotes are being removed versus very few coyotes being removed. That way, our participants feel comfortable with giving us accurate locations. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so let's take questions from the rack.
I have a question. Pursuant to taking a picture and providing accurate data that way, this may be a question, maybe a comment, but has the division given thought to the fact that a lot of areas where people are going to be hunting, there is no cell coverage?
Yes, and so the way the app works is it'll enter in all the data and it'll just hold that data there, and your phone can geo-reference regardless of whether you have service or not, and so it'll just save it, and then when you go back to your house and you do have service, then you can submit it then.
Okay, so
it saves all that info.
The app actually does that?
Yep, it does.
I've taken pictures with my phone, and the reason I asked this question, I've taken pictures in the roadless part in the Book Cliffs, and it said I was in Moab.
Oh, no, that's pretty bad.
You know, I'm in Moab. You know, well, I'm
one of the requirements.
I was 90 miles from Moab when I took the pictures.
You can be taking pictures in there.
I'm questioning whether or not this has been looked into to make sure it's going to be accurate.
It should be accurate. One of the requirements will be that that participants do have their GPS location data turned on, though. So, and the app will notify them when they open it up that they need to have it turned on.
Other questions from the rack?
So, obviously, everyone just kind of assumes that people have smartphones these days. Pretty much everyone does, but I know a lot of hunters that don't. They still use a flip phone. So, will that exclude them, even though they're active participants now? There will be no option to, like, individually subscribe to a paper version?
So, we are going to open it up to, like, a trial run for a year where it'll be optional, and then in July 2019, we're recommending to make it a requirement, which would then exclude those that do not wish to use a smartphone. But I want to clarify that we're not preventing them from hunting coyotes, we're just preventing them from gaining or receiving a financial gain for hunting them. So.
Okay.
I have a comment.
Is this a question or a comment?
A comment.
Okay, do you want to wait for the comment period?
Oh.
Is that okay? We're in the question period. Is that okay? Okay.
I have a question, too.
Okay, great.
So my question is, has the division, I realize that the purpose for the act that allows the bounty to be paid was particularly to increase the doe-fawn ratio. And Are you seeing, does the division have good data that it's effective in meeting the objectives of what the Act specified?
So currently we don't have an answer to that. I'm actually working on a thesis project to determine how effective it is, or if it is effective, by looking at how much spatiotemporal overlap there is between fawning and coyote removals. One of the reasons we haven't looked at it until now is because it takes a long time to collect the data, and also because we haven't had a due date pretty much for how long guys can store up coyotes. So there's a lot of, there's been a lot of missing information up until now. So
thank you.
Maybe something that would answer your question, if you look at the slides that they were showing during Guy's presentation, there was tremendous amount of predation by coyotes. So any coyotes that are taken are helping that the deer population, particularly the fawns.
So is this program shifting more people that direction, or are we just hunting aimless sagebrush flats with lots of rabbits?
So the majority of the coyotes are coming out of Box Elder County and Beaver County, and the vast majority, so I can show you those hot spots where it's yellow is where the most coyotes are coming out of.
Wouldn't happen to be the thoroughfare to Idaho and Nevada, would it?
What was that?
Wouldn't happen to be the thoroughfare from Idaho and Nevada, would it?
We hope not.
That's my fear.
Yeah. What are the other states doing? Are there any bounties in other states?
Currently, we're the only state that has a bounty on coyotes.
Do you know how the level of $50 was determined?
I don't know. I don't know if maybe Darren knows.
It was just, that was just in the language in the original bill, and that's a cap, so it can be up to $50, and it can fluctuate under that. We began the program at that level, so that's why.
And so then what currently happens when you run out of funding? Does it just stop?
Right. We haven't run out
right
yet.
Now? Oh.
But the funding would roll over. So the years when we didn't spend the $500,000 that money carried forward, we're getting to the point now where we're spending that over that bank, I guess, and we're getting to the point where we're looking at running out. And so in that case, we'd stop payments that year until if we got funding the following year.
But you're still asking for donations to that fund, correct, when people put in for draws?
This fund is appropriated by the legislature.
Oh, okay.
So
that okay, different.
Could change if the legislature changed their mind.
Okay. And what is that appropriation amount?
So up in every previous year, it's been $500,000 for payouts to coyote removals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's all coming from the legislature?
Yes.
So $5 coming out of the big game tags, where is that going?
That's going to the administrative costs, paying our technicians, paying for supplies, running the actual program.
Is this data that eventually the division might think about using, or would a goal be to kind of prioritize where maybe eventually you're paying a bounty during fawning in fawning areas and that's it? Because, I mean, that's where we need it. We don't necessarily need to pay a guy to hunt out where there's no deer, which we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. So it's been discussed, and part of the reason is we don't have enough data to back up any changes currently. And then on top of that, we are already addressing fraud problems, and so trying to make it to specific locations like fawning grounds may be too much of a constraint to be able to actually regulate with the manpower that we have.
And with how it is set up right now. I mean, that'd be easier with the app, right?
Yeah, potentially, yes.
You could do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any more questions from the rack? Okay, so do we have questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? I believe we do. Oh, do you have a comment card? Okay.
Oh, is that the first one?
Sorry. Okay. 7 minutes.
All
right, so Kevin.
Kevin Norman, SFW. We support the division's proposal on this action.
Okay, thank you. So at this point, comments and or motions from the REC.
I have one comment. I'd like to applaud the division's efforts. I can see a lot of thought's been put into this, trying to come up with ways to reduce the fraud in the system. I know there is a lot of fraud in the system, and I've personally watched lots of guys gathering up roadkill. And, you know, that's just, if you ask me, it's sharpshooting the system, and I applaud the division's effort to try and reduce that fraud, because, you know, it is our tax dollars at work, and we'd like it to be put to work for what it was intended and not somebody defrauding and sharpshooting. So I'm appreciative of that effort. I do, however, you know, I have concerns with how it's going to be implemented. I like the idea of using an app and being able to accurately pinpoint the location, but I wonder how well that's going to work.
I have a comment. What I've noticed since the bounty was first enacted in 2012 is that other prey species have increased significantly, and I'm surprised that the Farm Bureau and ranchers haven't voiced some objection to the bounty program, because the number of rodents, lagomorphs, has increased so much that, I mean, in places there's no grazing, but it looks like an area that has just been totally overgrazed because of the number of prey species that are not being taken by coyotes now. And I wish that the division would look more holistically at the issue of targeting one predator species with one prey species in mind to protect, and not looking at the effects of the increase in other prey species. So it's going to be difficult probably to shift gears, but part of the problem is, you know, in areas where there's not a problem with doe fawn ratios, there's no deer, you know, still people are out there killing coyotes just to get a bounty, and it just seems like it's not a sophisticated enough program to really target to meet the objectives that it was set up to do.
Any other comments from the RAC?
I guess I'll be very interested in the results of analyzing this, and maybe looking into literature review from other states if there were other bounty programs in the past to find out the success or not success. So, yeah, stay tuned.
One comment I do have, too, is because I think there was one out of Idaho, but which what can happen with coyotes, and I'm sure this isn't news to the biologists, but the more you kill them, the more they have. You know, so are we just spinning our wheels and spending $500,000 for nothing? You know, and I think going this direction will help us answer that question a little bit easier, because that's a legitimate concern and could absolutely be the truth that we've thrown away millions of dollars and there's just as many coyotes out there. We've been trying to kill coyotes for hundreds of years. They're not easy, so.
The government's been at war with a coyote since day one, and when the last man on earth is dead and gone, there'll be a coyote there to take a leak on him. So we'll never win the war with coyotes, but this is a proven method to help reduce the number of coyotes. It is effective, and there is data that shows that.
Yeah, there's also data that shows that it's not effective, and that you'll actually increase the population of coyotes in an area where
they've been removed. So, I mean, it has to do with the fecundity of the species, you know, if the populations seem to drop, then they have more pups. And transient coyotes will come and take the place of a dominant coyote in an area. So I would say that the data isn't real clear to support what you said, but... I'd like to make a motion.
Great.
I move that the Southeast RAC recommend to the Wildlife Board that a recommendation be sent to the legislature to amend the Mule Deer Protection Act to remove the bounty on coyotes from the General Predator Control Program and leave the Targeted Predator Control Program as is to better control coyotes where doe fawn ratios are below target goals. And the reason is determined by a study to be that the a study or studies be conducted that the problem with the doe fawn ratio is due to coyote predation and not other factors.
Okay. We're going to have to...
So was that a motion to send a letter? I missed that first.
A recommendation to the Wildlife Board to recommend that the legislature get rid of the program, the bounty portion of the program.
Okay.
I can read it again if you want.
That would be great.
Or at some point maybe just give us your paper too, or we can.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he'll be able to read my writing.
Okay. Say it again.
Okay.
Then.
Say what?
Say it again, please.
Okay. I move that the Southeast RAC recommend to the Wildlife Board that a recommendation be sent to the legislature to amend the Mule Deer Protection Act to remove the bounty on coyotes from the General Predator Control Program and leave the Targeted Predator Control Program as it is to better control coyotes where the doe fawn ratios are below target goals. And the reason is determined by study be due to coyote predation.
Okay.
What are your other methods?
Excuse me?
What are your other methods? What?
Well, part of the program is that, I mean, with the federal government and the state have hunters that go out and where there are problems.
Well, I'm fairly well aware with that, but is that what you're talking about? Is UDAF taking back over the complete control?
Yeah. I think it's more effective to have
I agree with you, actually.
Targeted hunters going out into areas where it's been determined that there's a problem and taking care of that problem rather than going out in the West Desert where there's no mule deer at all and just killing coyotes to kill coyotes for a bounty.
Well, I agree with you.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my recommendation.
Although your motion doesn't mention UDAF taking over the program or anything. That, am I correct?
It's just
no, I'm saying that
the bounty.
The Targeted Predator Control Program remain in place.
Okay.
It'll never be.
You have that? Okay. Do you want me to repeat that?
I don't know if I can clarify on that, but there's a portion in the rule that we have a contracted portion where we can pay contractors to go out and specifically target in certain areas that we specify, and then we also have the bounty program where any member of the public can go anywhere in the state. And I think he's excluding the bounty and wants to get rid of that, but wants to keep the ability to have targeted removals.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. I'm not going to repeat that. Is that okay?
It's good.
Okay. Do we have a second on that? So we have a motion by Garish. Do we have a second on that?
I'll second Garish's motion.
Okay, so we have a second by Sue. All in favor? So we have two. All opposed?
Seven
opposed. Okay.
And one abstention, is that right?
Okay.
Great.
He does in favor, Sue.
In favor? Sue and Garish.
In favor, Sue and Garish. Do we have another motion?
I'll make a motion that we go ahead and accept the division's recommendations as presented.
Okay, so I have Eric Luke making a motion to accept the recommendations as presented. Do I have a second on that?
I'll second it.
Okay, we've got Todd Thorne seconding. All in favor? 9. All opposed? 2. Garish and Sue. Okay. We'll take that to the Wildlife Board. I will take that to the Wildlife Board. Okay. So next, we have Mineral Mountain Bighorn Management Plan. David, is that correct?
Yes.
No substitution.
Thank you. I'm David Smedley. I'm a biologist in the southern region out of Miller and Beaver County. So I'm here to discuss our desert bighorn sheep plan for the Mineral Mountains. And part of the, you know, the Mineral Mountains, to give you a little background on how we got to where we're at with our plan. The Mineral Mountains looked like a great opportunity. Didn't have domestic sheep allotments as a great opportunity. We can put another herd of bighorn sheep and provide opportunity for people. And it was also in Beaver County that has historical records of sheep being in the county. So it looked like a great opportunity for us. So we created a draft plan. We went and met with the Beaver County commissioners about reintroducing bighorn sheep to the Mineral Mountains. Overall, we had support from the commission. We coordinated with the BLM. We've had support from the BLM. Following that, we went out and we met with the permittees that were on the mountain range. So all the livestock permittees that were within the unit boundary. We were able to meet with them, present this draft unit plan, and gather their input, suggestions, concerns, ideas, and try to fit that into the management plan. So we updated that to try to address some of those things. And then we went and took that plan again to the county commissioners. And most of the Mineral Mountains are within Beaver County. There's a little bit in Millard County just on the north end. So we took that plan to both counties. Both counties expressed overall support for that at that time. So then we once again met with the local stakeholders, discussed wildlife-related issues, and presented that draft plan again to those permittees and people at that meeting. So I'll give you an idea. The Mineral Mountains is kind of between Beaver and Milford. Beaver's on the west side, or east side. Milford's on the west side is where they're located. So the Mineral Mountain Range, we modeled over 100,000 acres of suitable habitat. And in that habitat, the majority of that is found on public land. Here's the map right here shows that modeled habitat kind of right up the center, right along the mountain range. The black would be the outline of our proposed unit boundary, and then that star is our potential release site where we've thought we'd like to release that initial transplant of bighorn sheep near the Granite Peak area. I should have mentioned this earlier, but as I go through this plan, this is just outlined as the plan. It kind of flows with the plan, so I'm just going to take it section by section here. But our unit management goals for the Mineral Mountains, we want to manage for a healthy population of bighorn sheep. We want to balance the impacts they have on local economies and cattle grazing. And then we want to maintain a sustainable population within the habitat, within that unit boundary. So our issues and concerns that we address within the plan, first discuss potential habitat. We modeled a lot of habitat, but we recognize there's still a lot of room for opportunity that can increase the habitat that's currently available to the sheep there. We discussed livestock competition. There's been found little dietary overlap with desert bighorn sheep and cattle. Typically, bighorn sheep avoid areas with cattle, avoid it where cattle are, and then they also select for very steep, rugged slopes. It's close to escape terrain, so they're utilizing areas that cattle don't typically use. And then they've also got minimal water requirements, which is another kind of nice thing with the desert bighorns. Disease is always a concern, so spatial separation is always an important factor there when you're managing bighorn sheep. And then predation. Cougars will likely be the biggest predator there for the sheep on the mountain range. Our population management objective, we'd like to achieve and maintain a population of 175 total sheep on the unit. And our objectives and our strategies to do this is we'll start with an initial transplant of 40 bighorn sheep. These will potentially come from Zion or the Muddy Mountains in Nevada, depending on the availability at the time that we're ready to that they're ready to get rid of them and that we're ready to take sheep. We'll monitor them, so we'll place a lot of GPS collars on those sheep that we transplant, and we look at their movements and survival. We'll monitor from the air every 2 to 3 years, and we'll also do ground classification and monitor how that population's doing. And then predator management before translocating any sheep there, we'll go through and remove predators with wildlife services. The disease management objectives, they like to maintain a healthy population of bighorn sheep, and maintain spatial separation from sheep and goats. Our strategies for this, will first, before from the test source, or we'll test the herd source, and then we'll use opportunistic testing once the sheep are on the mountain to continue to monitor the health status of that population. Spatial separation, identify areas of risk, and then look at those as the sheep are put on the mountain range. If we need to remove them, we'll remove them if necessary. And then we've also looked at potential areas for fencing if we need to help prevent any commingling between the bighorn sheep and domestics. Our habitat management objectives like to maintain and support sufficient habitat there to achieve our population objective. And then we support and encourage livestock grazing. That's on there. We'd like to see that happen. We'd like to also increase the forage production that is currently there through improvement projects. And then like to improve habitat and water availability wherever is possible. Our strategies for this will monitor habitat quality and quantity on an annual basis, habitat improvement projects, and water improvement. So these habitat improvement and water improvement projects that are listed here, these are as a result as we met with the BLM and as we met with the permittees on the unit. And as a division, these are areas that we looked at on the unit that could be beneficial and could have we can do those improvement projects and get them on the ground and help things move forward there. So our recreation management objectives like to provide hunting opportunities in accordance with our statewide management plan and then increase public awareness and viewing opportunities for the bighorn sheep. Our strategies for these, once again, the hunting, we'll recommend all permits in accordance with that plan, with the statewide plan. And then we'd like to use U-hunts if necessary to help maintain our population objective. And then the viewing opportunities, we go out and try to increase that awareness and expand those viewing opportunities for the public. Public involvement objective, we'd like to provide opportunities for the local stakeholders and agencies to be involved within the management process, which is what we've kind of done as part of that strategy is as we've gone out and met with them and proposed or let them look at the draft plan and give input on there. And then any plan revisions in the future, once again, those agencies and stakeholders and permittees will have opportunity to be involved in that decision-making process if this plan needs to be revised in the future. Our timeline for this is possibly as soon as fall 2018 that we could move sheep out there depending on that source herd availability at the time. So with that, I thank you. That's all I have for that.
I appreciate how fast you talk.
Oh, I didn't mean to talk that fast. I thought I was talking slow.
Good pace. Good pace. We have questions from the rack, and I have some. Go, Gersh.
So we received a couple of emails, one from Beaver County today that said that my read of it was that they're kind of lukewarm to the idea. They're not really that supportive because of the potential conflicts with some, I guess it's primarily some sheep allotments. How much of the suitable habitat that you've mapped is within active sheep allotments?
So let me show you this. So out of the suitable habitat here, there's no sheep allotments within that habitat. There's on the very north end, there's a sheep allotment that it's a cattle and sheep allotment, and it kind of comes into that very north end just a little bit, and it's out kind of on the grass and on that east side. But that allotment, they're phasing sheep out, and they're trying to put an application to convert to cattle. And the BLM's aware of that, but they're working through that application process right now. So within the next few years, that sheep allotment will no longer exist.
So one of the letters we received stated that they were not historically native. Can you...
Right, so there's records of in Beaver County, there's record on several mountain ranges within Beaver County that they are native.
Are they native there?
are they native there?
On that, on
so,
that
well,
it, ground.
That well, there's, I guess, there's a paper. Do you want to answer that, Jace? That he could probably be word that better than I can.
No, no problem. Thanks, Dave. No, my name is Jace Taylor, Division of Wildlife, working with bighorn sheep biologist. So probably the most comprehensive study that was done in Utah was 1971. The scientists were Dalton and Spillett. They did a good study going across the state looking at skeletal remains, looking at pictographs and petroglyphs, and also looking at historical records of sightings of bighorn sheep. And basically what they concluded is that bighorn sheep were found in every major mountain range and every major river drainage in the state, and that they were ubiquitous to the state. We have very specific records near this. It's in habitat that is less suitable. This is great habitat. There's no reason to doubt that bighorn sheep were there, and that's where we stand. Does that answer your question?
That helps. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So, David, you talked about moving 40 bighorns. Can you give us a cost on that, a general cost, so that we understand if we put those sheep in there and they don't make it?
I'm going to let Jason
okay.
answer those questions.
Yeah, so there's some variation there. It depends on where we get them from, not exactly how many. But if we're talking about 40 bighorn sheep, usually that ends up being about $1,000 an animal. Okay. And then we also have collar costs. It's $1,000 to capture the animal and to transport it. We also have collar costs as well. So, you know, and then there's also, you know, you can factor in how much we spend on habitat work. We plan to do a lot to do of habitat work, water improvements, to improve the range for cattle, the current cattle grazers, as well as the bighorn sheep. And we're committed to investing what it takes to keep those animals there.
One question that I have had brought up to me, and I don't know if there's a precedence for it really, but is that the adjacent permittees that do have sheep allotments might someday be held liable, whether it's from the division or from some other environmental group or even just non-governmental organization, if this goes south. You know, if we put 40 in there, we were wrong, they're too close, they get disease and they all die. Is there any legal protection for the domestic, or can, you know, somebody go after those domestic permittees and try to hold them liable?
Right, so we haven't had that in Utah. We've been very supportive of those cases. So I think, Justin, you're more familiar with that, or Jace, but currently that we haven't had any of those issues in Utah and had any sheep taken away from that. Do you have anything to add to that?
This has happened in the past. You know, there's countless times where we've had domestic sheep and bighorn sheep commingling, and we've had disease events throughout the state, and we don't have a time where we've gone back and tried to hold somebody liable. What we're trying to do is, if you look at bighorn sheep and back way up, when Utah was first settled, bighorn sheep were the most abundant big game animal on the landscape. And most populations were extirpated. All the Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep were gone by about the 1930s, 40s, and most of our desert bighorn populations except canyonlands. And so we're trying to restore these populations, and we recognize that in so doing, sometimes there's risk. But as we've had commingling events and we've had the die-offs and those types of things, we haven't sought out groups and said we're holding them liable. That hasn't been our interest, and we've done restoration work since 1966 in Utah, and we just don't have a history of that. So,
and there's no precedence of another, because I don't think the division would ever do that. I mean, that just is what it is. But there's no precedence of like some other NGO coming in and saying, "Oh, this is your fault."
Well, they might try to place blame, but the Division of Wildlife manages that resource, and so
there's no real,
yeah,
no repercussions that way. So.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have a question. From an ecological standpoint, just to use kind of an example, like the mountain goats that were transplanted on the Lascelles, kind of what you were touching on, and setting it up for another lawsuit because some other resource has been demised because of this transplant for something that's questionably native to the area.
So are you asking if there's something similar like that on the minerals?
Yes.
Not that we're aware of. In the BLM, I've discussed this. It's all on BLM property, but he says it's a very diverse, healthy, robust ecosystem. Lots of grasses, forbs, and shrubs, and there hasn't been anything that we're aware of that would be of concern there.
Along those lines, is there any habitat monitoring protocol set up now?
So there are some range trend sites there. And currently, so when we go through and monitor habitat, one of the nice things with the GPS collars, we can see where those sheep are using, and then we can go out and look at where we need to set up new monitoring sites.
I have a question. Kind of goes back to the cost that Trish brought up. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this cost is being covered by sportsmen's groups and the conservation permit program, correct?
Correct.
So the wool growers have asked for an MOU. I'm sure you're aware of this.
Right, they read a letter.
Are you guys willing to sign that MOU with the wool growers?
Justin, do you want to take that?
It depends on what the details of the MOU are. I mean, we're willing to sit down and discuss any of that stuff, but I think give a blanket, yeah, we're willing to sign any MOU.
Oh, and I understand that, but if you're willing to sit down and entertain the debt before... It's pretty hard to say, yeah, we're willing to entertain it and then make a decision here tonight on whether we agree with it. That's...
Well, if you look at our statewide plan, it's pretty clear. We wrote it this way by design. We're the Division of Wildlife, and we want to restore bighorn populations where we can on the landscape. And one of the phrases that we use in our statewide plan is that we want to manage for healthy, robust populations of bighorn sheep, but not at the expense of the domestic sheep industry. That's not what we're interested in. If you look at our track record in bighorn sheep restoration, we're looking for units like this that don't currently have domestic sheep grazing. We're not coming and proposing to put bighorns on the Manti, an area that...
But in all reality, I mean, if you look for track record, mm-hmm. you use the Elliott for an example... Once you guys wanted to transplant sheep there, the domestic sheep were gone not too long after.
In which unit? I'm sorry, where?
In the Elliott here.
Well, what we're talking, in situations like that, there have been situations where we've had willing permittees work with conservation groups and say, I want to convert to cattle or I want to do this, and there's financial gain to be had there. But that's a willing permittee situation. I can't think of a scenario where bighorn sheep have caused domestic sheep to be forced off the landscape in Utah where we didn't
I'm just saying, as a track record, as soon as the wild sheep have moved out, the domestic sheep within not too long are gone.
Well, that actually, the domestic sheep were moved ahead of time before bighorn sheep were placed there. So, but again, that was a willing permittee saying, yes, I want to work with a group like FNAS or something and financially get compensated to convert from domestic sheep to cattle. So it's a willing situation.
And I understand that. I'm just saying, as a track record, that's how it's happened throughout the state.
Yeah, okay. We're saying the same thing. Yes. Yep. Correct.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? So do we have questions from the audience? Troy.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Can you elaborate on where that come from? You say Beaver County. Can you tell me who it came from?
From the public lands director.
Public lands director. It just came out today.
Yeah. Public lands director speaking under what authority? I mean,
Kevin Whitaker.
Kevin Whitaker. All right. County. Not county commissioners, nothing like that, just public lands director.
Does it say, Eric? Does he have a specific?
Yeah. I did receive a phone call from their county commissioner just before the meeting started telling me that they opposed it last night, so it was tabled and was enacted on last night in the Southern Rack.
Which county commissioner called?
Tammy.
Correct. We'll address that a little later. Next question. We're talking about when they were there, native species. Are domestic sheep and cattle native to that country? Don't think so.
I don't know that we're real native either. To be honest with you.
I think we can all agree that that's a true statement.
Okay, are there any more questions from the audience? So we're going to take comments. And we have Brett Bailing from Utah Farm Bureau.
I'll just pass on some of the comments that were made last night at the Southern meeting. Farm Bureau has not been in the negotiations that the permittees and the cattlemen and the county commissioners down there have had, so we won't comment on what went on. But there were significant concerns raised about negative impacts to grazing. And we think that it was probably pretty close to them agreeing to it at one time, and at some point during the negotiations it probably fell through. So based on that, just because of the concerns to the negative impacts, Farm Bureau's policy at this point would be we would oppose it until, you know, the permittees would, you know, be agreeable to it. And as been said in other areas, bighorn sheep and desert bighorns and others that have come into the area, it's been under willing circumstances. And if the conditions were met, Farm Bureau would be in support of that as long as it wasn't negatively impacting grazing. So in other areas with other wildlife species, Farm Bureau has been actively involved in trying to help negotiate, especially with the buffalo on the Henry Mountains and other areas, to try to facilitate AUM transfers to help make livestock men whole down there. And we'd be willing to do the same thing here. But as far as this rack is concerned, Farm Bureau would officially oppose it today. But if the livestock permittees and the county commission and others were negotiated with at some time, we would like to help facilitate that discussion, because we think that we have much more in common on this than we're actually divided. I think the sportsmen and the livestock grazers can actually work together and make something happen that is beneficial to all. Some of the comments that were brought up, I will just point these out. A lot of the AUMs have been suspended in that area. Some of the ranchers have said that as much as 38% of their AUMs have been suspended. And they're saying, if there's not, you know, some cattle reintroduced because there's more feed, how can we introduce more sheep? That was one of the concerns that was brought up. Another one is, there's concerns about the bighorn sheep not staying in the area. Not sure that that's legitimate for this species, but the ranchers were concerned about that. Third concern was private land. There's about 25% of the area, and I'm not familiar with it, but it is owned by private landowners, and there's concerns about the sheep grazing on the private land and affecting that as well. So in addition to that, there's other concerns, but those were the major ones. So officially, Farm Bureau opposes it at this point, but we would love to help facilitate and see if we can't come to some agreement. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Brett. Next, we have Julie from the Utah Wool Growers.
Hi, everyone. I'm Julie Hansmeyer. You probably don't know me too well, but I'm north of the Danish Flat exit, and I winter there and kind of hibernate out there and have my sheep camp out there. We're lambing right now. And then I summer in Colorado. So I often don't get this direction, and I end up going that way, and I'm truly vested in Grand County, Utah, and the sheep industry. We raise merino ewes. We also run some cattle. So I do represent myself, and also I've been asked to represent the Utah wool growers tonight. We all know, if you read the news at all, there's been a lot of discussion about bighorn and domestics, and there's folks that have lost their permits. There's a lot of repercussions. Don't ever think that there won't be repercussions from something like this. And that's where we already have both species. But this is an area where you don't have the bighorns right now, but you do have domestic sheep. And the bighorns may move. And there's did you get a letter from the Utah wool growers? Okay, 24,000 head of sheep and 7 grazing permits in that area. That would be within like 20 to 30 miles. And that's serious. It makes my knees shake. And I'm not sure. I've got about 5 calls today say, Julie, can you take a break from what you're doing lambing? We lambed at, you know, Doc Lamb's this morning at 6, and I said, yes, I can come down and visit. And I'm not a stranger to this issue. I don't think we have to go to all the details. You know, I summer in Vail, Colorado, and, you know, I've been on a variety of boards. We do have a good although occasionally it's, you know, we butt heads, but working group with the Colorado Division of Wildlife, now the Parks and Wildlife, and the Bighorn Sheep groups and the division, or and the forest and the Department of Agriculture. So we have been working through some issues in Colorado. But I did hear a comment that none of our permits have been affected by bighorn sheep, and they have. And there's, a, you know, my personal one, my husband, before he passed, changed some of our sheep AUMs to cows. We run 200 cows now. And when I asked to, because I'm more comfortable with sheep, if I could change it back to sheep, and they said no. The BLM said, no, you cannot do that. And because of the bighorn sheep potential problem. So I have been affected by them, by this issue, even though the majority of our, and our neighbors are sheep. It's definitely unreasonable to think that, that nothing's going to happen out of this situation. I think there's so many issues in this state and in the country that we have to work through, and I think we're going to. And I hope if you don't actually vote no on this, I hope you'll do what the Southern RAC did and recommend to table it or to really work with those affected stakeholder groups and come to some kind of agreement and some kind of understanding. The wool growers definitely don't feel like they've been informed on this proposal.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Sorry to go over. It's okay. Okay. The next we have Jeremy.
My name is Jeremy Anderson. On this topic, I'm just representing myself. I do support the division's program or proposal as they've given it. I also think it's a hunting opportunity. It's conservation permit money put to work. I think it's a great thing for hunting opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Next we have Kevin Norman.
Kevin Norman representing myself. I found it very interesting last night in the Southern RAC, the Forest Service gentleman spoke of the Oak Creeks, which there was sheep reintroduced there about 5 years ago. And a lot of these same concerns were brought up at that time. And he said none of those concerns have come to fruition. There's been significant financial gain from federal funding and other funds. Sheep are a very valued resource and get a lot of attention. And there's a lot of money that can come in to improve the ground, the habitat. Also, as far as the sheep movement, they collared a bunch of those, and they basically all stayed within a 3-mile radius of where they were transplanted. And also as a sportsman, I think this opportunity is awesome to expand the opportunity to hunt sheep in our state. It's kind of a rich man's game, but this allows opportunity for the average Joe like myself. So I definitely support the division in this. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Next, we have Greg Bird from Utah Wild Sheep.
Hey, good evening, RAC members. I appreciate the time to be able to speak. Utah Wild Sheep Foundation is in full support of the division's recommendation. This has been a long time in the works. It's just not a, you know, in the last year and a half. It's been several years. And we think it's time to do it. There's a window of opportunity where we have a source herd that we lost 75 desert sheep out of Nevada last year because we couldn't get this through before. So it's a time to do it. You know, and we've heard about, you know, risk assessment and spatial separation issues. And I mean, this Green River rattlesnake sheep herd is a good example of it. We have domestic sheep to the east. And these sheep, they wander into it, they get removed. And this would be no different than right here. There are no active sheep allotments on this mountain. And then we talk about it, a lot of it, 25% of it is private. Actually, less than 5% of it is private on the mountain itself where the sheep habitat is. The rest of it's out in these desert flats. Yes, and occasionally we'll have a ram that will wander. That's just their nature. When they leave that black boundary, they die. We assume the risk. We know we're going to lose some. So if they leave that boundary, we want them dead, because we don't want them to bring the pathogens back in, because we know there are allotments out there. But there are none on this mountain. This is the perfect place to do it. And we're naive to think that we had sheep all the way around this and they didn't walk on that piece of dirt. So we were in full support of this. And it was brought up about the cost to get them here. Fanaz is ready to step up to take the lead in this and pay for this. And I know other sportsmen's groups are in the same, you know, boat with us on that. And we've also committed over $100,000 to habitat improvement projects on this mountain, water and land, on the private and the public. We need to remember this is over 95% public ground. We keep hearing about the issues about the cattlemen and the wool growers. There's guides and outfitters that make a living on this public ground too that never get mentioned on this. So it's multiple use. So we just need to remember that. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg. And then Troy.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Greg Green brings up a great point. Y'all have sheep right in your backyard. And quite frankly, you have domestics closer than what you're going to have down there. To say that this is a huge problem that's too close to domestics, almost every wild sheep herd in this state has some sort of risk factor with domestic sheep. Quite honestly, we've worked real well with them in the past. In realizing that once these sheep move, if they move, we remove them. It was just here a couple of years ago that these sheep moved towards Cottonwood and Diamond. I believe it was 6, 8, 10 sheep that we removed because they were getting too close to that allotment. The other thing, too, is I would encourage you to call the other two county commissioners. Tammy's speaking out of line. They have not had a vote amongst the three county commissioners. And quite honestly, there is some support for it. And so for her to say that, she is out of line. So I encourage you to call the other two county commissioners on that. As far as the other allotment that's talking about on the north, you know, that's Ensign Ranches, they are a current sheep allotment. They're in the process of moving to cows. He has full support of this, of having sheep on that mountain. The other thing I think we need to take into consideration here is, like Greg pointed out also, is the multiple use. As we sat in that meeting last night, yes, they did vote to table it. We were missing four RAC members. If those four RAC members were there last night, now granted, I admit, they weren't there. You go with the vote with the people there, it'd be a different story tonight. But the thing I want to focus on is it's not the issue that we're talking about. There's not enough feed on the mountain. Pete Yardley, who is North Divide Grazers, talking with him there, me and Pete had a conversation. And point blank, face to face, I says, Pete, you know there's enough feed for your cows on that mountain and these sheep. And he says, you're exactly right. But until you guys, the division, that are willing to sign a NEPA and give us the protection, there's no way we're not going to budge on it. Well, neither are we. So that, yeah, don't kid yourself. It's a posturing stance to say that there's no feed there. We'd support having those AUMs kick back. In fact, they are, that's private section in there. They are under a reciprocal grazing agreement, which actually already officially inflates the AUMs on the beyond because there's no fences and they can move back and forth. We support those cows there. Once again, there is no domestic sheep there. There is a strong support for this in the community. This started almost 8-10 years ago with the local Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife Committee. We've worked long and hard to get it to this point. So it's important that, you know, like we mentioned before, that this is multiple use. We need to look at other things. There's people that make money through guiding, outfitting, and recreational activities, and it's not just landowners themselves. You know, the notion that are trying to put the sheep industry out of business is simply not true. We've actually come to their aid. And quite honestly, there's no guarantee in the future that the feds or some other agency will try to force them out. But I tell you one thing, if the wool growers and the cattlemen are willing to stand by the side of sportsmen when that time comes, we'll be there by their side as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Thank you for all of your comments. It's really appreciated. It really helps us make some decisions. So, comments from the RAC.
I was glad that it was pointed out because there was a little bit of misrepresentation, the amount of public land, and there are correct me if I'm wrong, there are no current domestic sheep except on the very north end, and they are, as you mentioned, currently moving to cattle, correct?
Correct.
So, glad that was clarified.
How big of a boundary buffer zone there are you trying to hold around that?
Like where, like, what do you mean buffer zone? Like area
down
of risk?
From your domestic sheep allotments.
So, I guess where they wander to, is that what you're saying?
So I'm assuming all your orange ground is the mountain range.
Right, and that's mottled sheep habitat.
So I'm assuming all of the white ground is your high desert ground.
Right, yeah.
There's no sheep in any of that.
There's
alone.
Not.
So, and the closest. Nobody is against this. Nobody has come out and said this is a hard no. The wool growers have said that they are in favor of it if they can sit down and come up with an MOU. Also, Beaver County, right in their very first line of their email, said, fundamentally speaking, this is not. No one is opposed to the introduction of bighorn sheep, but nothing has been official. But they go through on a pretty big deal and list some concerns. I don't know anything about it, never been anywhere close to it. It's all I can do is read the emails they send, just like the sportsmen send to us. So that's my concern.
I'd like to make one comment. I come from a family that's been running cows for 100 years, but I also love to hunt. And my suggestions to the cattlemen in Emory County and the hunters is you better figure out a way to be on the same side, because there's a whole bunch of tree huggers out there and animal rights groups that don't want your bighorn sheep on the mountain, and they don't want to be stepping in cow turds when they're up there playing on the mountain. So if you don't learn to get along, you're both going to get hurt. So I would love to see the sheep on the mountain and the cows on the mountain and then figure out how to do this MOU, because there's other people out there that are more dangerous to you than you are to each other.
Agree.
Okay, if we don't have comments, maybe we'll look at a motion.
I'd make a motion that we follow the Southern Racks trail and table it until they can get things figured out down there the way they need to do it.
Okay, so we have a motion by Jeff Christensen to currently table the recommendations by the division. Do we have a second on that? I have a second by Garish. All in favor? We have five in favor. All opposed? Five. We got a tiebreaker. And then we have some abstentions. Yeah, okay. So we have Dana that abstained.
Okay.
Okay.
So you get the tiebreaker.
Yep. You got to vote.
I just really wanted to sit here. I'm going to go with to follow the recommendations by the division as presented. So move forward.
So you're opposed,
opposed
to the motion.
It fails 5-6, is what I understand, right?
Yes.
Motion fails 5-6.
Do we do that right? Should we say that again? So all those in favor of tabling the recommendations, can you guys?
In favor or opposed?
In favor of tabling.
In favor of the motion on the table.
Okay, so we have. And then those opposed to tabling.
No.
Just to tabling. Is that right?
Yep.
Just to, and
yep.
Those opposed. Okay.
Opposed to tabling then. We have the other five with Dana abstaining. And then you.
Yeah. Okay. With the opposition. So then we
have another motion.
We have another motion.
Okay. I'll make a motion that we accept the division's proposal as presented.
So I have a motion by Eric Luke to go with the division's presentation. Do I have a second on that? By Jace. All in favor?
Five.
Okay. All opposed?
You're the tiebreaker again.
Okay, so I'll go. I'm with Eric. So
passes 6-5. Okay.
You guys are being tough tonight. I really just wanted to.
You've earned your salary today.
Float.
So one abstention again. Okay. Is that correct?
Okay. I appreciate that conversation, and I agree with you, Lynn. I think we have to come together. That's just my fault. All right. So now we have Kenny propose rule amendments, conservation, and sportsman permits.
I've got a couch chair. I'm not going to be up before I'm out of here.
And did you notice how fast David spoke? Like, he was just, I'm just.
Hey, we're way ahead of last night.
No, we're good.
It's interesting. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, no pressure.
I will move as quick as we can.
Thank you, Chairman Hedin, RAC members, members of the public. I appreciate Justin and Guy and Makita and others for showing the tremendous benefits of our partnerships with each and every one of our conservation groups. They bring a lot of passion and energy and expertise to help us fulfill our collective mission. And so we're going to look at some proposed changes to help streamline some of the internal processes and reporting of expenditures of the conservation permit program. For those unfamiliar with the program, the Wildlife Board approves a small amount of permits, generally 5%, to be auctioned to generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities. The funding is divided between the group that markets the permit opportunity and the division, with 30% of the proceeds going direct to the division, 10% of the proceeds to be utilized by the organization for administrative overhead, and 60% retained by the organization to be spent on division-approved projects. The Wildlife Board, as Justin pointed out, has kind of asked us to find ways to report these positive impacts in a little more straightforward manner, and I think the changes we're proposing tonight help us achieve this. We're proposing, first of all, to strike an old vague section of rule that allowed groups to propose an alternate way to distribute these permits, and want to clarify that they only be initially distributed through competitive auction to the high bid. We want to also clarify that there can only be one statewide conservation permit per species. And then that third bullet clarify that any weapon permits, essentially rifle for the same species. If we have multiple rifle permits for that species, the conservation permit holder would need to select a single of those rifle seasons. They wouldn't automatically get multiple rifle hunts. Moving forward onto some reporting updates, we propose that all interest earned on the 60% of retained revenue be required for use on projects. That conservation funds committed to these approved projects be remitted sooner to the division, so within 60 days of invoice instead of 90. And third, that the retained revenue must be expended on or transferred to the division on those approved projects by September 1st, 2 years following collection. So that's an important distinction. Right now we track this as expended or committed, and this would actually be expended or transferred to the division, which allows us a little tighter look at those funds and we collect that into either the projects or the division sooner than before. So all the projects will be approved up front with a signed cover sheet. We will invoice for the total of what is needed to complete the project. We'll collect those funds, and the work will be scheduled and completed. And that last bullet point there, this process, these items will be entered and tracked in the division's database. So this change will allow the divisions to show the funds fully expended and the associated projects completed in our annual report, which is shared with the Wildlife Board and the public. And this update would actually replace the need for groups to provide that redundant detail in an annual report to us. We would still have it up front through the database. So moving on to some internal process updates with issuing and redeeming vouchers. We're developing some technology right now to help us better track and issue these vouchers electronically. This will prevent paper vouchers from being misplaced, delayed, or need to be reprinted. Groups must still provide the name of the successful bidder, the winning bid amount, and the date of the event where the permit was auctioned within 10 days of the fundraising event. If the successful bidder elects not to use a permit opportunity, they can designate it to another person as long as the conservation group is notified, the winning bid amount is not decreased, and an affidavit is signed verifying they're not profiting from the assignment. If assigned to another person, the group would then have 10 days to submit a complete voucher receipt to the division with the updated information. And this slide, excuse me, we propose to just clarify the current practice that the division can't or won't issue a conservation permit until the voucher information is received entirely and that the recipient possesses a valid hunting or combination license. They've paid the permit fee, and then someone at one of our counters has determined that they're legally eligible to possess that permit. And then clarify that these provisions we've just talked about in the last couple of slides also apply to the special Antelope Island conservation permits as well. And then lastly, with two final items on conservation permit rule, we need to, what we'd propose to specify in the definition section, that a conservation permit for turkey is not valid during the three-day youth-only general season hunt, unless that permit holder qualifies as a youth. And then we propose changing the conservation bison permit season to run August 1st to January 31st, and that's just to be consistent with other once-in-a-lifetime bison opportunity. Okay, next we have our expo permit rule amendments. For those not familiar with the expo permit program, it's a contract awarded in 5-year blocks with a renewal option for 5 years. There are two primary purposes. One is to generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities in Utah. And the second is to attract a regional or national wildlife expo to the state as well. As part of the program, the Wildlife Board authorizes up to 200 permits each year that are allocated to hunters through a drawing held at the expo. An application handling fee of $5 is collected by the expo organizer. 30% of these funds are required to be spent on division-approved projects, and the remaining 70% may be used for administrative costs to help run the expo. The current organizer has committed to spend the net proceeds of these funds to programs, projects, and personnel that support conservation initiatives in Utah. The majority of the amendments we'll see here on the next couple of slides came about from the last time we awarded the contract. And then some of the billing concepts that we talked about for conservation, we're going to mirror with this program too, to bring more clarity to these funds as well. So like all state agencies, when we contract with outside entities for services, we're required to follow state procurement code. When the last contract was awarded, we worked to align state law with the timelines in this rule, and they didn't overlap as perfectly as we wanted them to, but we absolutely followed the state procurement code. To remove any confusion, We're making it very clear that we follow the publicly noticed RFP process as outlined in state purchasing code. And so these rule revisions will help us harmonize the Expo contract application renewal process to be consistent with the state purchasing code. And this just makes sure that all interested groups know the process up front, they know the qualifications, and are considered through a standard formal procurement process. In that second bullet, we would like to clarify the division has authority to terminate the contract in interest of wildlife conservation, management issues, or compliance with law. And the third bullet, each year we field a handful of calls, I'd call them complaints, that certain lucky individuals draw multiple expo permits. And so we want to specify moving forward that applicants for expo permits would be eligible to receive only one expo permit each year. And if multiple permits were drawn, they would need to select a favorite within a couple of days of the division contacting them. And then similar to the proposal we saw a few slides ago in the conservation rule for the process streamlining, we are going to require that accrued interest on the application handling fee revenue that's dedicated to funding projects be used for projects, and that the same timeline apply, that we collect those funds within 60 days of invoice instead of 90. And then application handling fee revenue dedicated for projects, that third bullet down, must be expended on approved projects or transferred to the division by August 1st, 2 years following when it was collected. And so similar to that, invoicing for these projects up front and entering these into the database, the project details and the expenditures, that will replace the need for the expo contractor to give us redundant expo details that we already know in their annual report. And the division will continue to report this detail in the annual audit that we present to the Wildlife Board and to the public. Okay, so moving on to draw application procedures. Just a couple of minor adjustments to this rule. So we want to propose folding in the existing rule R657-55, which outlines waiting periods in the expo rule, into this draw application procedures rule. So we're just going to copy that section of rule over to this draw application procedures rule. And what that does is essentially gives us a single place to address all of these permits in this single location. And this is the current practice that's on the ground now. So we're just copying that over to this rule. And then all other waiting periods would apply. No changes to anything substantive there. And then lastly, a couple consistency changes to help us be consistent across draws for the applicants. We'd like to standardize the requirement for a hunter to possess a valid combo or hunting or combination license in order to apply for sandhill crane, sharp-tail grouse, greater sage grouse, and swan permits. And then lastly there, ensure that group applications consisting of qualifying youth, they get considered for that increased percentage of permits that we've talked about earlier tonight, allocated for youth for turkey, sandhill crane, sharp-tail grouse, and greater sage grouse. So essentially, if you apply as a group of youth, you'd get counted as youth and have a better chance to draw. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kenny. Questions from the rack?
You went over, and there was some changes on, well, not really changes, just clarification on how the expo contract or whatever will be awarded. How do you distribute the conservation permits? How do you decide which conservation groups get the conservation permits?
That's a good question. It's outlined in the rule, and they have to be a 501c3 organization that has a wildlife related mission, and then it's spelled out in there how kind of those permits are allocated and
is it a similar process? So like if two groups come and say we want that permit, then there's a similar process to decide which one to give it to?
Yeah, there's a whole, and Justin might be a better resource on some of this part of the rule. I typically deal with the back end stuff on the funding.
Numbers are fairly, they're not equal. I mean, some organizations get quite a few compared to others. So can you outline why really quick?
What was the question? Can you clarify?
How are the conservation permits allocated in a case where two qualified conservation groups would like the same permit?
Okay, so hypothetically, if you have a Henry Mountains deer tag, who gets the first shot at that permit? Okay, there's something called market share in the rule, and essentially what that means is whoever brought in the most revenue for this program, because this program is about raising funds for conservation, whoever brought in the most of that, there's a formula, and they would have the first choice. And then there's a second choice and a third, and it goes down.
It's kind of like a draft, don't you think?
It's like a fantasy football draft, if you will, in a way. And so whoever has the most market share gets ranked higher, and it goes down accordingly.
Well, then they get a pick, like, you know,
they get a pick
golden, but then they're at the bottom of the line again, and then the other groups can pick.
Yeah.
Okay.
For all intents and purposes, it's how it works. So the one with the next market share would get a pick next. And so it's not fighting over the same permit. It's not like auctioning it off. It's just when your turn comes up, you can choose the permits that are left.
What's left, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Justin.
Any other questions from the RAC? Okay, do I have questions from the audience? I have comments from the audience. So let's start with Jeremy from the Mule Deer Foundation. Glad to see you guys. Seen you in a while.
So I'm Jeremy Anderson. I'm the regional director for Mule Deer Foundation here in Utah. This is actually my hometown, so.
Oh, cool.
Even worse reason I'm not been down here, right? We're in full support of the division, how they've laid this out, and want to thank Justin for putting together that PowerPoint at the beginning. Whoever put it together for you, I'm assuming you. That's way over your head, right? It's awesome to see that, because that's our money on the ground. That's how we're presenting these things. Here in the southeastern region, the last 3 years, we've averaged about $250,000 per year in funding on these conservation projects. Again, me being from this area, the biologists know how to tug at my heart and say Buck Cliffs and Nash Wash and Sagers and things like that. And I tend to fund a little more money here, but it's a great deal. The expo permit money, I'm glad that they clarified in there as well, the 30-70 split. That 70% still is going to the ground. It's just we get to decide how to do it, whether it's purchasing urban deer trailers, which we have a huge problem up north with urban deer and things like that. So in full support, and thank you.
Okay, so next we have Kevin.
Kevin Norman representing myself on this. I too would like to thank Justin for his presentation. I think as I've got more involved with SFW as of late, it's been mind-blowing what this program really does. And the one thing I want to stress where I think everybody's done a poor job is telling about it. I think if the general public had any clue of what really went on, any true sportsman would have a hard time throwing rocks at this program. It's unbelievable. It's unique to our state, and it's amazing what gets accomplished through these funds. And I'm in full support of this conservation permit program. It's a little sacrifice, but in the end, it's really not a sacrifice. We have better herds, better habitat. And it's been awesome. So in closing, I guess I'd encourage all groups, including SFW, to do a better job at getting it out to the public what's being done with these funds. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, we have Greg from Utah Wild Sheep.
Greg Bird, I'll keep it short because I know we're all ready to go home and do other things, but we're in full support of the amendment proposals, and this program is amazing. It's given us as Utahns the ability to have the best wildlife in the country. I mean, bar none, the division has done a great job with us, and we are happy and glad to be partners with them. So we just applaud them for their efforts and hope it keeps going forward forever. Thank you.
Thank you. And Troy.
Troy Justinson, Sports Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to expand a little bit on what we talked about on this profit share and then also the draft. With these permits, they take a three-year average of what that permit brings. And so if you draft, say, like the Henry Mountains, say it's $98,000 average, that comes off the money. And so it reduces the amount that you have to continue to bid on these permits. So it's all based upon return. The more you return, the higher you get, the more money you have to spend to draft these permits. And so it's, you know, some groups have more, and it's all based upon performance on who brought more and to the table as far as the money generated. I want to speak a little bit to the expo permits. That is a huge difference between the expo permits and the conservation permits. The conservation permits are earmarked and specifically have to go back into big game. We are actually selling a voucher for that. The expo is an application fee, no different than what we pay Fallon Nevada that we're all hoping to hear from here in a week to see if we drew out, you know, type deal. And it is a 70-30 split. 30% goes into, or the $1.50 restricted goes into account. We have to spend that on projects that are approved by the division. The other 70%, like Jeremy pointed out, we have the ability to choose where it goes. It gives us that flexibility. As you watch through this thing, there are a lot of things that showed some different things that we funded, and one of which you've seen an urban quail. We took some of that money, and we actually hire a guy to catch urban quail. Jeremy talked about the urban deer project. Now we got the urban quail. Urban quail, a lot more dangerous than the deer, though. So, but it's a real exciting. Another aspect it allows us to do is to fund different aspects of wildlife, like in sports and fish and wildlife. We're not species specific. We cover everything, fish, waterfowl, upland game. We take a large portion of that money and put it into upland game and waterfowl. Pretty excited to announce that we just purchased 3 marsh masters to fight the frag. Those of you who are waterfowlers and know marsh, frag is the pinyon juniper of the wetlands. It sucks up the water. It also chokes out the native habitat. So we're excited that we've been able to purchase these marsh masters to have one at Farmington Bay, Ogden Bay, and Salt Creek to help get on top of that frag. We're excited about that. We've also taken some of that money and invested into water structures on our WMAs on the upland game and the waterfowl management units. Without water, you don't got no ducks. And so it allows us to be a little bit more flexible with that, and we're excited about that. You know, SFW's portion of that $5 app is roughly about $540,000 this year. Of that $540,000, I've committed damn near $530,000 to go back on the ground. 0% going to overhead. We're excited about it. I'm proud about that. You know, when actually those sheets go through and we see that's funded, we'll actually post it on our website to be able to inform people where this money is going. And once again, to remember, this is an application fee. No different than Fallon Nevada. We see 0% coming back from Fallon Nevada. But here these groups have chose to put it back investment in Utah. And just one last quick point. We as conservation groups get all the credit for raising this. Who really deserves the credit? Of sportsmen. This is a sacrifice. These are their permits, our permits, I should say. We took these permits out up to 5% to see if we could raise some money to increase our herds and do habitat work, and it's paid huge dividends. Thanks to the division. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so comments from the RAC. Eric.
I think it's a great program. You know, we go around and promote our banquets each year, we hear that this is turning hunting into a rich man's sport. I get that concept, but when you can take a small number of people and generate the amount of money that's being generated through these tags, and you look at all of the different studies, the programs, the transplants that are happening now, that weren't happening before this program. That's pretty cool to see.
Comment. Yeah, I guess I want to make just some general comments. I think Troy, you said this, it is a public resource, and sportsmen are sacrificing some tags for this resource. So just to keep that in mind, and I believe in conservation organizations. I was affiliated one for an extended period of time, and I like that we're solidifying rules, we're making sure that these organizations are accountable, that there's transparency. I think that's key. And it really helps your organization when you're putting it out there, like, this is how much we brought in and this is how much we put out. And so just kind of solidify that. But I like the solid rule change. Other comments?
Kind of echoing what you said, the transparency, I think, is huge, and that seems to be improving right and left. Not that I think it was ever necessarily real bad, but it makes it easier to, when somebody does say, it's making hunting Richmond sport, it makes it easy to say it. Another thing that might be interesting, as well as having the presentation on all the amazing things that we've been able to do with those dollars, that would be interesting, because, oftentimes that's it's maybe somebody from another state saying, oh yeah, Utah's doing it like that. It'd be interesting to see on that as well, the total amount of dollars that they have that goes to habitat, that they generate with their model versus right. ours. I mean, that's something that I'd be interested to see. I imagine I know what it is, but it'd be interesting to see. That's all.
Okay, so should we entertain a motion?
I'll make a motion to approve the recommendations as proposed.
Okay, so I have a motion by Todd to approve and seconded by Kent. All in favor? I think it's unanimous. All right. And then last agenda item, Martin. How are we doing? How are we doing compared to other racks? I'm always in competition.
Last night's racks was 5 hours, I believe, so we're under 5 hours. That's good.
All right, thank you. Marty Bushman again, the Attorney General's office. Got a handful of rule changes, pretty innocuous. They all deal with essentially the same thing. We were proposing to amend 5 rules that will effectively remove language that creates committees and then have the division take over those responsibilities. And here's the reason. This past year, we had some attention from the news media that looked at the Department of Natural Resources and its compliance with the Open and Public Meeting Act, which is the act that requires us to record all this and post it on the public notice website and minutes and all of that, agendas. And there were some boards within the department and agencies that took some heat, were not complying. Fortunately, Wildlife Board and the Regional Advisory Councils came out of it very well. But it did cause us to go through and do a little bit of a survey of the many different types of committees that we have and working groups and councils, and look at them and say, and reassess them, are they subject to the Open and Public Meeting Act? And we found 5 different committees, 4 actually, in 5 rules that are organized in rule, and by that fact alone were arguably subject to the act because they were created in rule. And they were committees that were never really designed to operate in a public forum. All of them dealt with issues dealing like individual issues. Somebody that had a concern with the division, they want to possess a particular type of species. They weren't policy type issues. And so what we're proposing is to amend those rules and remove the committees and just have the division organize within itself groups that would handle the responsibilities the committees had. So the 5 rules is the collection, importation, transportation, possession of animals rule, which is the certification review committee that's subject in that rule. There is an error remedy rule and an error committee. There's the amphibian and reptile collection, importation, transportation, possession rule. which is essentially the same thing as the top one, other than that Chapter 53 just deals with amphibian and reptiles. We have the recreational lease of private lands for free public walk-in access rule, and that committee there is the Walk-in Access Advisory Committee, and then the division's variance rule in the variance committee. So we'll go through each one of these real quick and try to give you an overview of what they are and what they do and what we're proposing. So the Certification Review Committee operates under the two different rules, one dealing with all animal species but reptiles and amphibians, the other one dealing with just reptiles and amphibians. The committee is comprised of representatives from the Division of Wildlife, from the Department of Agriculture, and Department of Health. And the committee makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board on petitions to reclassify species, to review and make recommendations to the Wildlife Board on variance requests for prohibited species, and to make recommendations on appeals to the board for COR denials. Responsibilities of the committee would be assumed by the division and exercised in consultation with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. We'd have the same people involved, just not a formal committee created in rule. The Air Committee operates under Chapter 50 of our rules. It's staffed solely by DWR representatives, and the committee makes recommendations to the division director on complaints seeking relief from division errors in the processing and issuing of wildlife documents. Largely, this is our application process, that if we've made some kind of mistake that's interfered with somebody's ability to get a license or permit, that there's a process that we can try to rectify that and put them back in the situation they were before the mistake. Those responsibilities under the proposed rule amendments would be assumed by the division, and the committee would not exist anymore. The Walking Access Advisory Committee operates under Chapter 56. It's staffed by DWR folks, sportsman interests, agricultural interests, and elected officials. And the committee makes recommendations to the DWR director on complaints concerning the fair and equitable treatment of people participating in the walk-in access program. Interestingly, a side note is the committee has never organized or met over the last however years it's been. So we've kind of determined it's a committee that may be a little bit superfluous anyway. And the responsibilities would be assumed by the division. Variance Committee operates under Chapter 57, staffed solely by DWR folks. The committee there makes recommendations to the Director of Wildlife on remedial relief sought by people substantially precluded from obtaining or using a wildlife document because of some kind of event or condition in their life that's beyond their control. So those responsibilities, again, would be assumed by the division. And that wraps up the five proposed rule changes, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? I don't think we have any comments from the audience. Comments from the rack? Entertain a motion.
Motion to approve.
Go to Todd. Is that it?
Yeah,
okay, we have a motion from Todd Thorne to approve the recommendations as presented. Do we have a second? And seconded by Dana. All in favor? It's unanimous.
All right, thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.